attracts strong sentiments on both sides of the argument. But there is far more that unites us as Conservatives than divides us. If you look at what the Chancellor's achieved over the past 6 years, turning the economy around from the brink of Greek-style ruin to a position where we have the lowest claimant count unemployment since the 1970s, he's done a great job. The government's done a great job. And we are midway through a process of social reform that I think will make a lasting difference to this country. So we need to accept the view of the British public. We need to carry on now delivering the manifesto. We've got another 21 bills to get through in this coming session of Parliament. That's all part of what we were elected on 15 months ago. So it's beholden upon us to unite and get on with the job.
Yeah, you'll concede it. It is quite curious, though, to hear those who've been on the opposite side for weeks now talking about their wonderful record in government again. Just this week, I think it was, you talked about the South East becoming a very different sort of place if immigration went on unchecked. Do you think that is a message that will go through to your leader?
Well, it clearly is the case that if Remain wins, this will be more challenging to deal with immigration, as we've said in the last few weeks, but that will not stop us as a government listening to the will of the British people, acting on what they've decided for us in relation to our membership of the European Union, and getting on with the job of doing what we can on a whole range of fronts, including...
So you can still, presumably, negotiate with the EU if it is a Remain. Do you believe that?
Well, we're going to have to carry on working within the European Union to get what's right for Britain. We're going to have to carry on delivering changes that make a difference in this country. On the immigration front, we've just passed a new immigration act that I think will make a difference to the challenge that we face. But we will carry on doing everything we can in the interest of the country off the back of the mandate we got 15 months ago.
Chris Grayling, thank you very much indeed. We're just hearing that Theresa Villiers has said she understands the Remain vegetable. We should put a massive caveat in at this point in the night. An hour on air, we've not had a single result in, so the night awaits us. David.
Kettering in the East Midlands in Northamptonshire is another place. We've just had its turnout. This is really interesting. The turnout 76%, and it was 67% in the general election. More people have registered. And the turnout is 76%, and so it's probably even more actual people voting. Look, I've just been joined by Douglas Carswell, who's the UKIP, the only UKIP MP. Now, we've got rather mixed messages coming from your leader, Nigel Farage, if you still see him as your leader, saying, first of all, that he thought that Remain had done it by a decision, and now saying that he's unconceived.
Well, I think we should take this with a large pinch of salt. I seem to remember, on the night of the general election, similar projections about Thanet South going the other way, which turned out to be slightly off-key. Let's look at the fact. We're going to see Sunderland fairly soon. Let's look at some hard facts before we know. What we do know is that it's likely to be very, very close. And who would have thought, after everything that has been thrown at the Leave campaign, taxpayer funded propaganda and the rest of it. Who would have thought that it would be this close? I think it's been an extraordinary campaign. I think Vote Leave has done incredibly well to narrow the gap and reduce the lead. Perhaps not quite enough, but perhaps they have done it well.
What's the future of UKIP and UKIP supporters as a party if, in fact, it's not a victory for Leave?
I think there'll be many people after this campaign in all parties who perhaps feel that the leaders of their parties on the issue of Europe and many other things have more in common with one another in Westminster than they do with ordinary folk across the country. And I think many people will conclude that politics is a cartel and we need to break that cartel and we need new upstart parties like UKIP to break that cartel. If UKIP is an optimistic party that wants change and that looks to reshape the country for 2030, 2040, not go back to 1950, we can be that change.
Sitting on your left is Amber Rudd, the Conservative MP for Hastings and Rye, and Energy and Climate Secretary. Thank you for joining us. You were the person who was quite rude about Boris Johnson in one of the debates, saying you thought the only number he understood was number 10, because that's where he wanted to be. The mood of the campaign, the style of it, was very vicious within the Tory party.
Oh, Dave, I'd like to think I made some interesting points about climate change and women's equality as well. But actually,
they may have got lost in the insults that you levelled at Boris Johnson.
Really insults. I mean, Boris is not made of porcelain and he's perfectly content. We have a very good relationship.
He's not the man you want to drive you home at the end of the evening. What was that then?
Yes, that was mean we shouldn't get in the car with him and let us drive us out of the European Union.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was rather a double.
No, absolutely not. No, you mistake me completely. But actually, there's been a lot of talk about people having disagreements within the Tory party, and as Chris Grayling said earlier, there's been some fairly robust discussions. But there's also, I feel, already coming together this evening, people who've had very strong views on different parts of the Conservative Party, already reaching out to each other and saying, whatever the outcome, and as Douglas said, it's too early to say, we are very hopeful, we will unite again afterwards.
No, but the Conservative Party united is one thing. I think what Douglas Carswell was referring to is large numbers of voters being disaffected by that.
But that's
assume for a moment, let me make no assumptions about who's won and who's lost, but the country was asked to make a decision between black and white. Are you for or against? Which is a difficult decision. I mean, countless people have been saying, I don't know how, I can't make up my mind. Once they've made up their minds, and they then find the other half of the country's gone the other way, they're bound, aren't they, to look for another, and somebody else, something other, some ideas to represent.
Well, there may be people. I was out campaigning in Hastings today, and what I had is quite a lot of enthusiasm from people coming up to me and saying, actually, we've rather enjoyed this period of thinking about why the European Union works for us and how Britain is stronger because of being in it. And they've enjoyed the campaign, it's brought them together, they've wanted to get together and talk about it. And actually, I think it's had quite a binding effect on people as well.
Well, whether they're yes or no.
Yes.
They're not.
Well, thinking about the politics of whether and where Britain's place is in the world and whether we are best served by in the European Union.
Which are we against?
Who are going to feel that they haven't got their way. And I want to see a new consensus. I don't want to spend the next 20 years having sort of divisions over Europe that we've had over the past 20 years. If it's the case that need nudges, I would like us to reach out to those who have genuine, legitimate concerns and, with a new consensus, take into account those concerns. Similarly, if it's Remain, we need to make sure that that considerable number of people who voted to leave the Union are represented and some of their views taken on board.
But how can they be taken on board? The campaign you run is that the EU doesn't listen and that it won't alter. That's why you want people to leave.
After the Scottish results, there was a consensus that even the Remain and the Unionists agreed that there would be some devolution of power to Scotland. And I think even if it is a narrow Remain, we need to recognise that that considerable significant portion of the electorate who voted to leave.
But we're going to plough ahead
to have some
everybody
Are you saying that the EU, after all, the arbiter of these things, will listen to the voice of people who've said they wish to leave and change their policy and their way of doing business? I mean,
I think it might happen, but can I just pick up something that Douglas said, which is that Prime Minister's never said he's fighting for the status quo. What we're fighting for is making sure that the UK has a stronger role within Europe and that it's good for Europe to be able to, good for the UK to be able to do that. We don't want things to stay still. We want to make sure that we can influence the European Union so it's in our interest and is stronger. But what I do agree with Douglas about is that there have been issues that have come out of this campaign which no government would ignore. We need to engage with them more, listen to people more about it, and address them.
Amber Rudd, how on earth do you do that, though? It was part of David Cameron's campaign that if you stayed in, you were voting for a reformed Europe, something that would continue to change. But just this week, the president of the EU Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, was plain as plain could be. He said there would be no more change after the February deal. And the February deal that David Cameron had promised was so bold that most people can see he was actually pretty much tinkering around the market.
Well, I think we both know what the president was saying, was don't expect another renegotiation if you want to have another referendum. My interpretation of what he was saying is completely different to what you've just suggested. It's saying, don't come back and ask us to have a different deal, have a referendum.
But so many members of the public want something else.
And we will hope to influence that to take place by working with other European partners to do that. On the renegotiation, I think people dismiss it too quickly. The fact is, on the crucial case of immigration, we've got a renegotiation with Prime Minister whereby European Union citizens come here to work. They can't take out until they've put in, they can't get full benefits for 4 years. That is quite a fundamental change. And once we vote, if we do, to remain, that will be a change that I think that people will appreciate.
But you also know very well that the Prime Minister has not been able to get as much as he wanted on immigration, and he has not been able to offer what he and a few went into on that.
But you underestimate what he did, Jim.
I don't think anyone should be under the impression that because of the way people voted on Thursday, fundamental problem with effective management is the fundamental flawed project and the failures within it and extension to it. I think
you
need to recognize that.
The European Union
whether
the
invasion to leave or to stay is fundamentally flawed in its current form.
But Douglas, I hope if we vote to stay, you'll try to work within Parliament to make sure that we get the best for the country by working with the European Union, not always taking the position that we should leave the European Union, if that's the outcome of the British people.
Well, let's see what we're going to do. I think it's going to be neck and neck.
Let's hear a bit more about the result from Jeremy, who had his beautiful explanation when we go about the size of constituencies now, the size of the count.
Bare mechanics, I think, Dave. Yeah, yes, I could give you a result. But so just the way it's working. When you start with two Westminster elections, the parliamentary constituencies we have, 650 in Westminster, roughly this. Same size. It's not like that for this referendum. Let me show you what I mean. We have here a proportionate map. So each county area is different. Some are much bigger than others. I'll show you the smallest here. The Isles of Scilly, they are just down off the southeast coast, very, very small indeed. And then actually next to it, quite a big stalk here, which is Cornwall. Cornwall counts as one county. The height of the stalk represents the number of people in the county area. The biggest stalk you can see here in the Midlands is Birmingham, just there. And we'll focus in a minute on London, where there's an awful lot of votes, but 33 different boroughs all reporting singly. Have a look at Scotland as well. A lot of votes in Glasgow and Edinburgh. Not so many elsewhere, but Scotland thought to be going much more for Remain than any other part of the whole of the UK, and therefore Scotland may well be a crucial part of all of this. And if I take you down towards London, you'll see this forest of stalks, which represents really the density of population in the south east of England. So let's zoom in on London here and see those 33 boroughs, including the City of London, which is tiny, just 7,000 electorate there. Here they are. The height of the stalk represents the number of people who can vote. And it's quite possible, with Remain sentiment high in London, that all of these turn yellow by the end of the night. If they don't, if some of them go blue for Lee.
The earliest you're looking at is 22. And the new leader is going to do it.
It is not appropriate. It is not appropriate to berate those people who are here. But there's been, we've slipped. We've slipped 6 minutes. We've slipped 6 minutes. At this rate, we won't finish till 3 a.m. Now, we're on to, you all know that Alan, our colleague at LSE, is making the case for Brexit. With a press briefing, we're laying on a range of things. We expect people to come. We expect people to go. I'm saying this for our colleagues. There's an array of stuff, and we're grateful for you all to come here. We're trying to get behind the headlines, and we're probing in this session, which is a session that carries on until midnight, possibly breaking to hear what Gibraltar thinks. What Gibraltar thinks. The five people in Gibraltar. And it's not a reflection on Gibraltar. It takes them hours to count the five votes, nor is it on the Isle of Scilly. Or the Isles of Scilly. I'm unaware how many isles there are in Scilly. That, we may break for them, we may not. We may treat them with contempt. But the action will begin with terms of votes later. Tim Bale's warning to us that it's not a done deal. Dunleavy's warning that it might drift back to 50-50. We need to remember. I think it would be foolish of this group to assume in. Too early. There isn't a vote on the table. There are no exit polls. There are a few opinion polls. So let's get started. We have the panel. We don't have Michel Petit. He's been called away. We do have Klaus, who's going to be the first Danish ambassador. We have Catherine, a former colleague of mine from Cambridge. And we have Damien, a current colleague here at LSE. And the topic would be turning up, possibly, the hard bargain, legal settlement for UK inside or outside the EU. Ambassador, thank you very much for coming. I want to tell you, we're very strict on timing. Chalmers goes on forever, so you have to set a very good precedent.
Give him more time. 5 minutes.
This man, ladies and gentlemen, a consummate negotiator. This is the Danish guy who pops up when Cameron is rushing past trying to knock over Angela Merkel. He's the guy who tidies up afterwards. I'm going to kick him off with a question.
on the bridge. You're at this for years. You're the ambassador here. Yeah. Forget you're an ambassador. Nobody tweets. Are the British utterly impossible to negotiate with? Ambassador. 5-6 minutes.
Well, of course you would expect me to say I would like to reply after I know the outcome of this referendum.
Yes.
But I won't. My answer is very short. No, they're not impossible to negotiate with. Luckily. My experience with the Brits is, over many years, they're extremely good in defending their own interests. We would just like them to do that more actively in the European Union. And of course...
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. Spontaneous piece of Euro enthusiasm.
Exactly. Otherwise,
it's like Danish rhetoric to get us all riled up.
Otherwise, I will be unemployed, no? Good. So, legal settlement in or out. Well, of course, seen from a Danish perspective, we came in together with the UK in 1973, if you have not forgotten it, together with Ireland. And we, of course, would very much like that the UK stays with us. It was not by coincidence that we came in together. It was a strategic choice of that time when we were outside the so-called six in the EC, but for economic and trade relations and fundamental reasons, the EFTA arrangement of which the UK has invented to try to counterbalance the EC at that time didn't work out to the benefit of the British economy and the Danish economy and the Irish and the Norwegian for that sake. So we wanted to enter. So that's what it's all about. And that's history, of course, now, but that history might come back in the event of a Brexit, because then you would probably be pushed back in the UK to some kind of EFTA arrangement or free trade arrangement or whatever it might pop up with. And the UK will, to some extent, be back to square one, the situation where they were in 1973. Hopefully, we hope that the UK and the majority of the British people, of course, tonight, will decide to stay within the European Union. And in that case, it's quite clear what's going to happen. And the legal issues will be quite simple. We will just have to implement the agreement we have agreed with Mr. Cameron in February at the European Council, and it has to be implemented, in our view, to the letter. And I think also with quite a lot of confidence that that will be the outcome of the European Council conclusions next week on Tuesday and Wednesday in the when the outcome is a Remain vote here. And there's no doubt about it that the Commission and the European Parliament will also confirm their support to this agreement. Apart from that, we might also, let's say, send some kind of message, but of course it remains to be seen. But it's my guess, my best guess, is that we might also send a message to the British people saying that we have heard what you have said, we have listened, and then we might, let's say, reflect upon it.
But the one thing they seem to have said is, please, no free movement of people. And you've reflected on that quite early and said nothing can change there.
That's only in the case of leaving that will be relevant. Because one thing I have learned during my many visits around the UK, which I have done over the last 6 weeks, is that many people, let's say, if we can make sure there's no abuse or fraud from migrants with access to social benefits, we'll be very happy. And then I get a little... Personally, I get a little bit frustrated because a very important part of the agreement we have made with Mr. Cameron is exactly that. So I think, in my humble opinion, that the knowledge and the information about the true content of the agreement made with the UK, that could probably be communicated a little bit clearer, because it might also comfort some people in their worries about the impact of migration in this country as far as the access to social benefit and welfare benefits are concerned. In the case of a leave vote, of course, things look pretty difficult and pretty different. And the only thing I would say to that at this stage is that the starting point, it will be for the British government to interpret the outcome of a leave result. And then we will take our positions in Denmark and in the European Union on the basis on the conclusions which is drawn by the British government of such a result. And the reason why we say so is not just for diplomatic convenience, it's also because we know, formally speaking, the referendum is not binding. It's not binding on the British Parliament. We know that, politically speaking, they consider it binding, but it means that we have to know from the Prime Minister, from the leader of the British government, how they interpret an outcome like a Leave majority and what they intend to do about it.
Yeah, thanks. We'll leave it there, Clough, for now, and come back on question and answers.
Sure.
Catherine, the ambassador is sort of slightly saying that agreement, you know, is going to be followed, it's fairly straightforward. We've all forgotten about this agreement. None of us can remember from Adam what he said. Is that agreement, if we're in, easy to deliver in legal terms? And if we're out, how easy or how hard is that?
So I'm going to do the in bit.
Yes.
And Damien's going to do the out bit.
Oh, in and out, a kind of team.
Yeah.
you might be surprised, but it's true.
Excellent.
I'm going to talk, it's migration I want to talk about, and what's really struck me over the last few weeks as we've toured town halls around the country is the very differing approach to migration. So we did a town hall event in Spalding where the only issue people wanted to talk about was immigration and God. And we discovered that in respect of immigration, they were against it, and in respect of God, they were in favour of him. They said, God is English, don't you know?
Very well.
We went to Oxford only a couple of days later, and nobody mentioned immigration at all when we were there. And that really is, in microcosm, the nature of the issue, because for some parts of the country, it's a major issue. Others, they can take it completely in their stride, and I suspect that we'll see this in respect of the votes that are coming out. In respect to the deal in February, I got shouted at in a church in Aylsham about whether the deal was legally binding of precise nature. I want to talk about the complexity in the deal, which is about the two things, the two big ticket items that David Cameron negotiated, the so-called emergency break and the limits on the exportability of child benefit. Now, as you probably know, these were in the deal that if there is a vote to remain, and I'm going to talk on the presumption that there is, that this will require to be delivered an amendment to a directive, the Citizens' Rights Directive and the Social Security Regulation, both of which require qualified majority voting in Council and agreement of the European Parliament. The Council obviously is sewn up. There's strong indications, and you know better than I, that the European Parliament will agree to it, even though it is a directly discriminatory measure. Stumbling block might be Court of Justice, and the fact is the moment that the directive is amended and a poll arrives and asks for in-work benefits, and note the emphasis on in-work benefits, it's not about out-of-work benefits, it's in-work benefits, it's tax credits, it's top-ups, is denied, then they'll go to the British courts, they'll go to the upper tribunal, and then a reference will be sent off to Luxembourg. And, of course, that does kick the can down the road, 2 years down the road, and then there'll be a challenge, and then the court will be in a dilemma, because the court in the past has been very strict on directly discriminatory rules. This is a classic case. On the other hand, we also know that the court has become much more state-friendly in recent decisions, Dano being a case in point, and last week, very conveniently, just before the referendum, commission in the UK. So it may be that the court takes a view that actually this is part of a deal and it doesn't want to upset the apple cart.
I thought the court was a kind of legal body and not a political body. You're describing people who keep an eye on the politics.
Well, they do. There's that lovely line in that wonderful article by Eric Stein who talks about them tucked away in the fairyland of the Duchy of Luxembourg. In fact, they do actually read newspapers and they are highly sensitive to what's going on at the moment, it's quite clear, and there has been a real quite significant volte face. So that's the first point I want to make Have I got 2 minutes to make a second
Yes,
point?
You do, absolutely.
My second point is something actually rather, I think, rather more interesting, which is buried in the agreement in February. And while you might have forgotten it, of course, it will come to light again. Now, in respect, the benefits stuff is a massive red herring. And it's a red herring because it's dealing with a problem that doesn't actually exist. All of the research shows that people do not migrate to the UK for benefits, and certainly the research that I've been doing, the interviews we've been carrying out, we have yet to meet anyone who even knows their way how to get to the job centre to start applying for benefits, let alone how to battle the complicated forms in another language in order to get those benefits. Now, it must be said, all our interviews have shown that they've all said, or most people have said, we know somebody who's abused the system, but it ain't us. And certainly all of the serious academic work has confirmed that people are not coming for benefits, and frankly those benefits are so small that you wouldn't give up the magnificent food and culture in your own country to come here for those. And so it is
yeah. Like Ireland, for example.
Exceptions to everyone. But what's interesting is that there is a serious point that there are certain communities in the UK who feel that they have been very disadvantaged by migration. They feel that they have lost. You just need to contrast Cambridge, cosmopolitan, very open to migration because migrants aren't a threat. You need to go 15, 20 miles up the road to Wisbeach, and the story is completely different. I should say as a footnote, as far as Wisbeach is concerned, it has been inundated with another sort of immigrant, namely journalists from right across the world who've identified Wisbeach as the most deprived area, and they've been banging on every shop door saying, what do you think of immigrants? And to which the answer is, we don't like journalists. But what is clear, there is a very serious issue there, and there has, and this referendum debate has brought this very much to the fore in a way that these communities had not been addressed before. And what's interesting in the deal, if you look at the very opening paragraph of Section D, which is the fourth basket of the deal, there's some rather interesting language. Now, given that you've only given me a minute and a half, I won't give you chapter and verse, but for those who are interested, you should just have a look at the language. And what seems quite striking if you read the language is that the emphasis in the language is on people coming who've already got jobs. And it's not about people coming who are looking for work.
Can I just hold you up? But you're not losing your 40 seconds. We have an announcement from, yes, that part of the UK known as Gibraltar. Well, absolutely. I'm sorry, we'll come back to you. This is
the number of votes cast in favour remain a member of the European Union was 19,322.
No surprise. A place none of us knew was in it wants to stay in it. Catherine, we interrupted you, but for a reason. Lovely timing, team. I don't want to stop your last minute and a half. Complicated point, and it's an important one because this is about background. Yeah. The fourth basket.
So, the fourth basket, the language is quite careful and suggests, first of all, that migrants should be coming if they have got jobs to take up offers of employment. The old language in Article 45, which is what the Spark report had said, was Spark had envisaged that people only move when they actually had jobs, not to go looking for jobs in other countries. And furthermore, the other striking thing about the that opening paragraph is it seems to suggest that even directly discriminatory measures can be objectively justified by things like concerns about reducing unemployment and encouraging local recruitment. There is some wriggle room in there for some creative thinking in order to try and deal with the problems that Spalding, Wisbeach and the others are facing.
Well, very interesting. Damien, do stop. But that's a subtle point about the role of law and the way law can affect things. My own thought as we go to Damien is it too late for the court to develop this more nuanced position? But we'll see. They can only react to what comes before them, of course. Damien, you're not the out guy personally, but you're going to tell us what on earth will happen if it's out.
I think there's a real... My starting point is, what if no one talks to us next week? And this might happen under either of the paths that have been proposed by various proponents during various of the campaigns during the referendum. Of course, Vote Leave, who are very worried about the 2 years that the Article 50 process provides for negotiations and think it's insufficient, have talked about, well, we'll have informal negotiations first. The Article 50 process will just be to cross the T's and dot the I's, and that's how it will work. And in some ways, that gives the UK a better negotiating position. But that's the very reason why the other member states will probably be loath to do it. And in fact, listening carefully to what the ambassador just said, and also reading the Times and the Financial Times, the other member states are making it very clear they're unlikely to do that. So the formal process of invoking Article 50 will have to start sooner or later. There might be some wiggle room, depending what happens to the Prime Minister. However, say he notifies the European Council next Tuesday that we are formally going to leave. It's still not clear they'll talk to us initially, because the next stage is the European Council has to adopt guidelines, which have to be adopted by unanimity, that frame their approach for the negotiations. Now, there are two things that are interesting about this. The first is that none of them have leaked so far during the process, and I can only assume that is because this was seen as too sensitive during the campaign, that no national government was going to try and do it, and so this has not been done yet, or in any significant way. And the second thing about this is this one might be where much of the action is for many member states. So if you are the Baltic states, for example, and crudely, you know the eventual deal has to be done by a qualified majority, about 16 states have to say yes. You have big stakes over free movement of persons here in the UK. You will make sure at the moment of negotiating the guidelines that something is in there, even if Germany has completely different objectives. So the conclusion, this could lead for some quite interesting discussions between the 27, which could drag on for a time, about what they actually want from the UK. And that will then drag on in due course into the French and German elections. So there's every possibility that negotiations don't start for quite a while, or don't start seriously for quite a while. Now, the problem from the UK's position is that the two-year period starts to run from when we formally notify, so possibly next Tuesday. The fact that no one speaks to us for the first 7 or 8 months is not their problem, it's our problem. The second thing, and I'm sure this has gone through the minds of foreign ministries and game theorists in other European capitals, is there's no real reason to speak to the UK until sometime probably around April 2018, because if everyone suffers from disorderly exit by the UK, the UK suffers the most. And therefore, the UK's bargaining position will weaken day by day during this two-year period. And what was instructive about the leaks that it came out was how some states seem to be preparing for this. So what came out in Financial Times was that if the UK tried to play hardball during this time by not obeying EU law or various sanctions, there are currently things being discussed. We obviously don't know what consensus is for invoking the Article 7 procedure, which involves either sanctions against the UK, and they don't have to be proportionate, or just bunging the UK out, full stop. And so I think the UK has got to be in a position where it's got to be prepared to be quite lonely for most of the rest of 2016 and possibly early 2017 as well.
Can I ask the three of you a question before we go to the audience? Let's assume, we don't know, and they're saying, or behind us, they're saying very close, etc., and we don't know, but supposing it's in, and Mr. Cameron makes a speech about pursuing a reform agenda in the European Union, and he's going to go and shout at all the leaders again about all this stuff, about how nasty they are, and that you should listen to Britain and so on. What is the appetite for making space for the British case post a narrow win for Remain? Are they likely to say, Ambassador, come to you first class, are they likely to say, look, you've had this, would you go away? Or are they likely to say, we'll try our best?
Well, first I will say, I hope the result on the outcome will not be 102% from Orkney and Shetland, because they want to come back to Denmark. Yes?
Somebody tweet that immediately.
So, anyway, so, no, to answer your question, no, they won't say so. And I think many people, and also in your question, many people have forgotten, or they don't want to know about it, or they have not read the what we actually wrote into the agreement with Mr. Cameron in February. Because a part of it is a reform agenda. And it's not very revolutionary, because it's basically also as in line with the kind of reform agenda which is already listed in the Commission's work program. So what you actually could do when it's a remain result, which of course we still hope, then it's relatively easy to come up with a roadmap for embarking on a number of serious substantial reforms in liberalizing the internal market, on the energy market, on the capital markets union, and on services and so on. And that's already inherent in that. And the UK will absolutely, I think they will have a kind of an upper hand in that, because they have the presidency of the European Union in the second half of 2017. And at the same time, in the political reality will be that when we move closer to 2017, then Germany and France will be very much inward looking in preparation for their elections. So, and we could, and therefore a space will open for a more proactive UK role.
So we'll hear from Derek. European directives upheld by the European Court of Justice, navel-gazing by Germany and France, an agenda set by Britain being followed, 2017, Britain the leader.
I'd agree with everything the Ambassador says. I still wouldn't see the UK as the leader. All this stuff was an acceleration, largely, of an agenda that was already pre-existing. Now, in terms of whether the UK has a wider agenda-setting role, I'm rather sceptical. There are three big parts to the EU, Schengen, the euro, and the single market. The UK now is in one of those. It is really inconceivable to imagine a British president of the European Commission or the European Parliament or the European Council. And the other thing that has to be said, and this British tend to forget this, because this has been a navel-gazing, I think, in the UK, other states are probably a little, particularly those in the euro area, probably a little bit fed up of listening to the British record on this. After all, they've made bigger reforms in budgetary politics. They've been more successful at getting their budget deficits down than the UK. They've made very swingeing labour reforms, if you look at countries like Italy. And if you look at the record of the Cameron government, one can't really see where, how, in terms of its actions rather than its rhetoric, how it's been more pro-reform than many of these states. The other point I'd make that I always make is if you look at the top 11 states in Davos who are most competitive, seven of them either from the EU or use EU regulation. The idea that Davos sees the European Union as some sort of competitive basket case, someone better tell them.
Yeah. On my point, Catherine, and indeed what you've heard, then we'll go to the audience. Think about some questions or comments, guys.
So on a reform agenda, particularly on premium to persons, Juncker, demonstrating an extraordinary capacity to shoot to the Remain side in the foot, said no, there'll be no attempt at reform. Not very helpful, because this is an issue not just for the UK, but other member states too, the Netherlands, Denmark itself. Sweden has got a growing Eurosceptic party. There is appetite for reform. The question is, how much space is there to actually engage in that reform? UK, of course, has also spectacularly burnt its boats, because if you remember, the UK took out adverts in the Romanian press saying, don't you dare come to England, we don't want you. And now we go hoping that Romania might actually help us in these negotiations. We haven't played our cards very cleverly.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I wonder the extent to which Mr. Cameron discovered that on his tour of European capitals. Grew up politically, possibly. Questions? Observations.
At least in London, not.
Yes, sir.
So much time, so
I
just
want to come to you. Name and observation relatively concise, please.
Hassan Azmal, an alumnus. The ambassador said we EFTA didn't quite succeed. Okay. The ambassador said that EFTA was failing. It wasn't actually failing. The whole project was a political project, because EFTA and EU tariffs, or the old EEC tariffs, were merging. By 1979, it would have been a free trade area anyway. So it was always a political project. The other point I want to say, is there a possibility that we can take the heat out of the immigration issue by linking the social fund with the number of immigrants that come to each country? Because that would take a lot of the heat away. We could use the extra funding to fund our hospital, the extra NHS needs, the extra education needs. So is there any such possibility?
Hi, Celia Peterson. I'm a clerk to the House of Lords. I was just wondering, in the case of a Leave vote, what the panel thinks the likelihood is of a UK presidency in 2017 and how that would play out.
Thank you very much. Have we a third? We do, over here. Please, yes, you can take off this jacket you make for.
Hi there, Renaud Thier from Policy Network, and I'm a European Institute alumni. Also about the UK presidency next year, but in case of Remain, I mean, the ambassador suggested that there would be a sort of window of opportunity for the UK to lead on the agenda. What sort of specific areas do you see that as, you know, promising in terms of setting the agenda? I mean, for instance, do you think there could be scope for an EU budget reform? For further reform of EU free movement rules, as it has been suggested in the last few days of the Remain campaign.
Thank you very much. I think three's enough for now. We've got time, but not a lot. If you want to start, Alice, you pick what you want.
Yeah, okay. But let me just, I'll try to reply to all of them, not at the same time. But on migration, and also following what you said very wisely, the very fundamental you have to have in place in order to deal with politically and economically with the migration issue is that you start to be very precise on what you're talking about. In this debate here in the campaign, it has all been mixed up, deliberately or non-deliberately. Asylum seekers, economic migrants, illegal migrants, third country migrants, EU migrants, people moving around, people seeking jobs. It's all very different issues and very different, and you have to take them one by one, and you can only deal with it if you are ready to go into that discussion. Secondly, I would say in the European Union, there's two kind of free movement. One is for workers, which was the original free movement from the Rome Treaty, and the other one is for persons, just moving around for pleasure or seeking jobs. Economically speaking, the most important thing is free movement for workers. The free movement for persons is a commodity. It's a benefit, but it's not an economic necessity. That's all what I would say to that.
Yes.
European presidency 2017, in all likelihood, no matter what the outcome of the vote will be tonight or tomorrow, I mean, the UK will be a member of the European Union for the next 2 years. Therefore, I mean, they will, I mean, take over the presidency to the extent that they want it. I don't believe that other member states will put a question mark on that, so it will be for the British government to decide whether they actually want to assume that. And there are rules in the Council Rules of Procedure. If a country do not want, for any reason, to assume the responsibility of presidency of the Council, then it will go to the next following presidency. So that's very easy. Finally, on reform, what kind of reforms? I would say, if you listen to the debate in other European countries, I think the only place where you hear about a EU army or you hear about taking a leap forward in Eurozone integration is in the here in the UK. If you listen to the debate in all other member states, and I'm not talking about Brussels, but I'm talking about other member states, you don't hear that. They don't talk about that. It's way beyond where the political reality is in other member states, including Germany, including France. If you saw the Pew polling the other day about the attitude to the European Union, you saw very clearly that there are other countries where people are much more skeptical towards the European Union membership than the UK. The reforms I would say there are three things that the public expects the European Union to help the member states to deliver. It's economic growth, it is jobs, and it is to manage and control the migration issue from outside, not free movement inside. That's all.
I might stop you there because we're up against the clock, and I want to hear from Catherine and then Damien, and I've got to find a quick one, and then we'll wrap up. Catherine, the questions we heard.
So I want to particularly deal with the gentleman's question over there about what to do with migration. Your point about the European Social Fund, really interesting. And I would say what was really striking to me, the only time anyone's mentioned the European Social Fund to me was when we went to a prison and we did a town hall event in a prison. And they were really worried that if there was a vote to leave, the ESF money would dry up, which has been used to provide education and rehabilitation of offenders. Now, I think that that's, money does need to be thrown at the problem to an extent, because towns like Wisbeach, towns like Spalding, if it's proving very difficult to get your kid into the school, local school, and you're a British person, of course you blame it on the foreigner. A lot of this is actually to do with total failure of domestic government expenditure policies, or more to the point, the introduction of austerity policies. Now, this government isn't going to say we've seen the light on austerity. Indeed, quite the contrary. They will say that austerity is the only way to go to get our budget deficit down. So there is an inherent tension there, but there does need to be targeted funding in those areas where people feel that they have really been left out. And if the EU could help as well, that would be a clever way forward.
Brilliant. And Damien.
Just two very brief points. 2017 European presidency. I remember back, I think it was in 2011, there was the Czech do-nothing presidency. This is how they marketed it. So you can have empty presidencies and the EU continues. It might be in the UK's interest to be seen as a neutral broker during quite delicate time in the negotiations. There might be something for it. Following on just from what the ambassador said about the reality of other, what happens in other member states, for me the key moment was 2012, when the financial system was really going to go bust. There clearly wasn't enough money in the European Stability Mechanism. Mm-hmm. 500 billion wasn't going to do the trick. No one put a euro more into that fund at that moment. And in fact, they were looking, particularly the Finns, at ways of taking the money out. And that shows that when push comes to shove, that was the moment when one saw really the limits of integration in the euro area. It's not going any further.
Simple yes or no to this one. If there is a push for really quite radical reform in the European Union, which fits with the British agenda post-Remain, does law have the capacity to be a roadblock? Or is law something that does not constrain a fairly radical set of changes in the European Union?
Law is flexible.
Law is flexible. Damien?
Law, first of all, the euro area states can do anything they want, more or less, without amending the treaties. Secondly, the EU is moving away from a legal union in the single market to one based on private standardisation. So law, in my view, is becoming less relevant. Law is difficult on free movement of persons because the rules there are stickier, and that is one of the great cleavages of our time.
So not perhaps as flexible as Catherine might think, but manageable. Ambassador, I thought you were saying laws manageable.
Except treaty change. I don't think there's appetite for treaty change on this side of 2018.
Thank you. Now, look, you've got, starting in 35 seconds, you've got the UK and Europe and the world, which is in the wolf's ear. And remember, we have Keisha Briggs, who ran the whole terrorism thing. He's not your foreground. But we also have, of course, Clarence Smith, Mike Cox, and Stephen Woolcock, the AG from the International Relations Department here at Tennessee. And you have 10 minutes to, and I regret to see a growing presence of alcohol in the room, you have the opportunity to take these glasses and return here in 10 minutes for probably the result from the city aisle, or aisle, depending on how many of the city places there are. One or two other things, for some of the people counting very carefully and speedily, and the economy, where we get under the surface of the stuff we did in the classic NSC way with the great team of NSC. Can we end by thanking our three colleagues?
Thank you very much.
In 10 minutes, some of you.
We have to talk. Yeah. Pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's really helpful.
It was very good. Yeah. Please keep talking about it. It's a well kept
high turnout in Scotland. It's a well kept secret. And 80%, not quite the 80%, 70% referendum turnout in the independence referendum. But we're very, very proud in Scotland of the positive campaign that we have fought. And I think that will reflect a high turnout and a very hopeful for our vote for Remain. But it's still early in the
game. It is, of course, early. And if Scotland looks like a Remain, we're going to hand straight back. We've got a Newcastle result, David.
2016, under the European Union referendum Act 2015, and having been authorised to do so by the Regional Counting Officer, I hereby give notice that I have certified the following. The total number of ballot papers counted was 129,000. And 72. The total number of votes cast in favour of Remain was 65,404. The total number of votes cast in favour of Leave was 63,598. The total number of ballot papers rejected was as follows. No official mark, 0. Both answers voted for, 20. Writing or mark by which the voter could be identified, 5. Unmarked or void for uncertainty, 44. The total number of ballot papers rejected was 69.
So there is the first result from England and from within Great Britain that we've had, and it shows the Leave campaign just a little bit behind Remain, not nearly as much behind as all the experts had been saying we should expect from Newcastle upon Tyne. 63,598 Leave, 65,404, and that is 49.3% for Leave, 50.7% for Remain, and that could be a very significant result because it's against the predictions that all the experts had made about what Newcastle upon Tyne would do. John, you were talking earlier on about students and people with degrees and all that, and that was why Newcastle was likely to be fairly firmly in the Remain camp, not so.
Well, that certainly seems the case. So it may be possible that the experts are going to have egg on their face later on tonight. Or it may be that this is a first sign that the Remain side are not necessarily going to do quite as well as those early polls suggested. I'll give you a couple of other things, David, that might give the Remain side reason for some concern. The first is that it looks as though the turnout, which may be across the UK as a whole, is going to be over the 70% mark, may well be lower in Scotland than elsewhere in the UK. There's not been much of a campaign there, partly because virtually all the politicians were in favour. Maybe that will work to the, against the Remain side, given how pro-Remain Scotland is expected to be. The second thing is that we've spotted is that we have quite a lot of places now where they've declared their turn-up, and it looks as though in places where there's a relatively large number of pensioners who we know are more likely to vote for Remain, that these places have seen a markedly higher turn-up than in those places where the age profile is predominantly younger. So, you know, these are just straws in the wind, but these are first straws in the wind. But shall we say, if 10 Downing Street was feeling a degree of relief at 10 o'clock this evening when they heard the YouGov poll, maybe the champagne's gone back in the fridge.
And we should say, of course, that for all that we show Newcastle upon Tyne or Sunderland or wherever, in the end, every single vote counts. And it's that's why Scotland's important, because if Remain people haven't turned out in Scotland, then that those votes are lost.
Yes, the pattern of turnout in this referendum is as crucial as the number of votes cast.
We have Orkney. Let's see the Orkney Islands result. Leave 4,193, Remain 7,189, and that's 37% for Leave and 63% for Remain. It was expected to be strong for Remain, but reasonably strong for Remain. And we haven't got Sunderland yet, still not declared. Let's go to our reporter in Sunderland. Do you have the result in Sunderland, Naga? Do you know what the result is?
No, David, we don't have the results in Sunderland. Not yet, David. We don't have the results in Sunderland. They're keeping a very close eye on Newcastle. Of course, that 1,807 vote split between Remain and Leave, that result from Newcastle came through. We've spoken to Remain campaigners here. They were quite pessimistic. We spoke to three Labour campaigners. They were expecting a 60-40 split towards Leave. We are expecting the result, though, in the next 10 to 15 minutes, hopefully.
What did they make of what happened in Newcastle when that news came through?
Very surprised at how close it was. I mean, lots of raised eyebrows here from the counting officers. Very surprised indeed. They aren't expecting it to be as close here, but as we know, as the evening turns out, what can we say? They're keeping a very close eye on all the results, but as I said, we're expecting a result here in about the next 10, 15 minutes.
All right. We go to James Landell at the Remain headquarters. James, good evening. What's the reaction to that first result from Newcastle?
Well, I have to say, David, before that moment, there was a pretty cheerful, optimistic mood here. But definitely when they heard that result from Newcastle, there was a distinct sucking of teeth. But I think a little bit of the wind had been taken out of their sails. The mood here, I think, is still hopeful. They've been talking about how they hope that the economic argument has finally hit home, that the Labour vote has finally begun to harden a bit. They also, they think that the Leave's immigration argument began to peter out, they say, towards the end of the campaign. But I think at the moment, the one thing that's worrying them, if you talk to one or two people here, is those postal votes. They don't know what that is. They, for them, that's one of the big unknowns. So still, I'd say the mood here is, you know, cautious, optimistic, hopeful. But I think that last result certainly made them think twice.
It's interesting because we were talking about the postal votes here. And I think, Laura, your view was the postal votes, people thought, were largely to Leave.
Absolutely. All the chatter, all the expectation of the last couple of weeks, postal votes coming in very heavily.
Do we have an idea how many postal votes, what the numbers are?
I don't have an exact number, but again, as we're seeing in the turnout reporting back from today, very high turnout on postal votes, huge numbers coming in, which reported much higher than people who were.
I mean, 25% something.
Something like that. Somebody said in their area it had been as high as 40%, but I don't have an indication of the actual.
Maybe John Curtis does. John, do you know how many postal votes we're talking about, if we're talking about them tending towards Leave? 2, 4, 3, 5, 6 million, how many?
Well, we're talking, I think, about 20% or so now of the electorate is being registered to vote by post. We expect them to be disproportionately older people, so I don't think we should be surprised that they're relatively strong for Remain.
No, but how many votes, how many people cast postal votes? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, well, the level of turnout amongst postal voters is always higher than the turnout amongst the country as a whole.
How many people cast a postal vote?
Well, we have an election of, what, 45 million? It's 20% of that, so sorry.
What's that? You're the mathematician.
I'm not that quick, right?
10 million or so.
If John Curtis couldn't do a song, the nation falls over.
Yeah, he can do it. Anyway, 9 or 10 million. Let's join Nick Watts at Arron Banks headquarters for the Leave campaign. Nick, are you there? Oh, hello. Yes, good. What was the reaction?
Yes, you just heard from Nigel Farage.
Yes. Go on, fire away.
We've just heard from Nigel Farage in rather chaotic scenes here. Nigel Farage conceded, unconceded. I think we'd now say that he's semi-conceded, though obviously that might change when he sees that result from Newcastle. What Nigel Farage is doing is really setting up a battle on two fronts. A battle if Leave have lost against Vote Leave, saying they were too cautious, but also a battle against the Conservative leadership, saying that he will still continue this battle, he's not going to give up, and will be almost looking to Scotland and hoping that you'd be in a never-ending referendum territory. But I was also talking to Kate Hoey, who's one of the leading figures on the Labour-Leave side, and she is saying, when we look at that Newcastle result, that is perhaps telling us the story of this campaign that people really only woke up to at the latter stages, which is this disconnect between the leadership of the Labour Party, who are overwhelmingly in favour of EU membership, and the grassroots members who do not share that view of the European Union.
Nick, thank you very much. And just to clarify, by the way, in case you're confused by these headquarters, this is the, where we were talking to Nick Watts, is Arron Banks. Leave EU, that wasn't the one that was recognised as the official Leave campaign, which is Vote Leave, who aren't having a party for some reason, I don't know why,
Why aren't they having a party?
Until 10 p.m. I kid you not. Until 10 p.m. We were focused on getting out the vote. Dominic Cummings and Matthew Elliott quietly and efficiently been putting together the most amazing campaign. They don't have time for champagne. They've been too hard working.
Oh. Nigel Farage should put the champagne on ice ready, you see.
I prefer to.
Awful. Emily.
David, I'm going to pick up with Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh again, our MP from the Scottish Nationalists. And that point that John Curtis was making about turnout being absolutely central in Scotland and in London. Orkney's, I think we've had in at 68%, which was lower than many would expect. Is it possible that the turnout was depressed because of this uniformity, if you like, of message that was coming through, all the leaders saying the same thing in Scotland?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I think it's important, though, and a great positive point, that the leaders were united in their view that it's best for Scotland and best for the UK to remain within the EU. And if you contrast that with the campaign that we've seen across the UK, which unfortunately has been very much based on, you know, internal Tory party fighting, exacerbated further, as we can see now, by a letter that Tory MPs have found themselves requiring to sign asking Cameron to remain. And we've heard from Chris Grayling earlier on in the programme when he was talking about having been a signatory to this letter. But let's remember, there are government ministers that did not trust David Cameron, their leader, the Prime Minister's judgment on the issue of the EU referendum, and therefore I think there's a lot of work that requires to be done within the Tory party, whatever happens as a result of the referendum.
There may yet be work for the Remain camp. What you saw, we watched that result come in from Newcastle, a win for Remain, yes, but on a very slight margin. Does that start to put the panic into your camp?
Well, indeed, all of the results we've heard so far have been wins for Remain, so I think we've got such a long way to go, and I think, as everybody is agreeing, it would be impossible to predict the result, and let's hope that it's one that will benefit Scotland and probably the United Kingdom.
Nicola Sturgeon suggested during the campaign that if there was a Leave vote, Scotland might decide it was time for a second referendum. It was a big enough, momentous enough event to trigger a second referendum on Scottish independence.
Is a challenge.
If it is a Remain vote, and as you say, we're at the very beginning of the night, would the SNP then put any thought of a referendum behind it?
It will come as no surprise to you that the SNP wants independence for Scotland. We, of course, respect the result of the referendum we had in 2014. But it is absolutely a matter of Scotland whether we're to have a second independence.
Oh, absolutely.
But the calling of it
is not for any politician or anybody else to dictate to the people of Scotland when that.
But would that go off the table? Do you think if it was a safe Remain vote, would that second referendum of independence for Scotland then just be off the table completely?
Independence for Scotland should never be off the table. It's a reason for being for the SNP, and we would love
no intent to.
An independent country within the EU with our own voice and then seat at the table, batting on behalf of Scotland at every juncture.
Tasmina, thank you very much. David.
Emma, just before you need us to make way for another guest, I know you're getting to.
It doesn't matter.
At this stage, just a little bit uneasy about what's come through.
David, I'm going to be uneasy until we've got the final result. It's all to play for. It is going to be quite a long night, but we remain very hopeful that we've made a good case that the people will vote to stay in.
I know you hope that, but I ask you whether you're feeling uneasy, not whether you're going to be cautious, but are you feeling uneasy about that Newcastle result? It's the only result we've had, and it's, according to John Curtis, who's been working this out, leaving aside Gibraltar, he's been working this out for months. It should have been a much bigger gap between Leave and Remain.
As you say, there's over 380 of these results to come in, so yes, I am uneasy.
Right, I think that's a very good way in which to end it. Yes, I am uneasy. And she's still talking, you can lip read. You can lip read, because we put it on every now and again to remind you how lucky you are to be at LSE and not watching the telly. Because what we do, we try and get under the surface of the subject. I've said that, and I'll say it again before the end of the evening. And the subject, as Tim Bale reminded us, is a subject about two potential eventualities. And there was a little exciting moment when we thought we were discussing the implications of Remain, but we are not, as Tim Bale warned us, discussing the implications of Remain. It is an open question. And what we have this evening, in the light of the Newcastle result, which has given people who know things like John Curtis pause for thought, we thought it would be a good idea to get an economist from Newcastle. And to kick us off is Angus. This panel is the one without John Van Rienen, but with Swati from LSE, for which many, many thanks for coming in. The others are in the programme as it appears. And we're going to do the usual thing. If you've been here this evening, you'll know it'll be a shortish presentation, interactive, and then over to you. This ends at 5 minutes to one. So we have a little bit less time than we'd like. We're starting as many as 5 minutes late, but we've caught up on the 7 minutes late at the last one. We need to keep on time. Angus, director of something called Macroeconomics, NIESR. I'm a lawyer. And senior fellow, UK in a Changing Europe. The brief is very vague. The economy. Thoughts on either way? Either way, a lot of stuff talked about during the campaign. Your perspective now.
Thank you. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And I am from Newcastle, although you probably can't tell from my very London accent now. But we were up there, I think, last week. We went to Newcastle, Leeds, York. We'd been to Cardiff, Belfast, all over the country. And the surprising thing is that people are surprised by that. We were at a university, lecture theatre like this, and although there was just a majority, we had a vote, just a majority for Remain, it was very, very close. But that's a university. That's not on the street. And a lot of this had been divided socioeconomically. So one of the things that was so interesting was just how divided this is by region. Now, let me just look at some of the economics. And what's quite interesting here, on the one hand, you know, there's been this great consensus amongst economists that it would be a catastrophe if there was Brexit. But what I think is most disturbing is how little impact that made on the electorate. I mean, to be honest, when you go to see people in places like Leeds and you say, oh, this is going to be bad for GDP, they're sort of looking at you thinking, what has that done for me lately? I mean, really, how does that matter for me? And I think that's a very interesting challenge for economists. One of the MPs that I follow on Twitter mentioned that many of the poorest will vote today to make their lives worse because they don't believe they can get any better, which is a really sad indictment as where we are in terms of economic policy. And in this institution, which is, I think was founded by the Fabians or supported or something like that, I mean, everybody's got in. I mean, where is the challenge to this? And I think this is a very important economic issue. One of the reasons why I think we have this effect is if you look at GDP per head, it's great. It's back to where it was before the Great Recession. Try looking at median real income, and it's just stopped falling. So it's all about inequality. So what's this referendum about? Well, on a sort of superficial or proximate level, immigration. I don't actually believe that very much. I don't think this country is particularly xenophobic. I don't think it has been for hundreds of years. What I do think, inequality and what happens in different regions, I think that's quite a big issue. The idea of take control is very interesting as well. You know, after Bretton Woods, the architects of the post-war system, Keynes and Dexter White, they deliberately said, let's not have capital movement so national governments can use national policies for their own people.
Can we just interrupt you? Because, Angus, there is a Sunderland result.
The total number of votes cast in favour of leave was 82,394. The number of ballot papers rejected was as follows. No official mark, zero.
Right, isn't it?
Both answers voted for.
Right, let's just, we've now had this second result in. Let's just go to Jeremy Vine and see where, and I'll come back to you, Ruth, in just a second.
I think if you don't mind, we'll give old Jeremy Vine a miss. Vicky is whispering in my ear that this is a good result for Remain. Can you, in a second, do the Tony Travers job? I don't see Tony. And tell us why. And then we're back to Angus, because we have to control the structure of the evening. But you were saying that, and I'm interested in why you said
that. Well, Sunderland was meant to be certainly voting to leave. And the expectation on the radio when I was coming over was that it could be 60-40 in favour of leave. Now, unless I've got my calculations wrong there, that didn't look to me like 60-40. Right. It looked like a very small margin. And if that is the case, the Sunderland result is the one, apparently, that gives you an indication of what will happen overall in terms of the
Let's come back on the percentages.
May I misread the percentages? So it is as high as that.
Sorry, I think it's a bit dismal from a Remain point of view.
Case, I just saw the figures at the bottom.
Yeah.
It's outperformed. Yeah. Sorry. In that case, I misread the figures. Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Angus, I'm going to nip in with a question for maybe all of you. The Queen opened this building and said, why didn't economists understand the crash? This building had happened, a famous question.
Yeah.
You guys, if I may say so, economists were not able to communicate the connection between GDP and ordinary living standards. That is a major failure of somebody. Is it a storytelling failure by politicians? Or is it they're not getting good advice from the civil service? Or what's going on that people can't correlate and we end up with a situation we're in that you were describing?
So just to pick up the point, since we're in the LSE, I think that's a very interesting point. Just down the road, also in the LSE, you had Charles Goodhart,
yes,
who has the finance department, and he must have been talking about the problems in financial regulation for at least 5 years before the crisis. But it wasn't considered to be part of the mainstream economics, and I think that's where the problem is. So Swati and my own institute, the National Institute, Swati did a fantastic job. They were way ahead of the game, but all of us predicted GDP. And my feeling is that hasn't actually been the issue. And so immigration in terms of inequality, trade in terms of inequality, but also, as I was saying about Bretton Woods, where, you know, they deliberately stopped capital control to allow national governments to capital flows, to allow national governments to address domestic policies. Well, what do you have today? Completely open capital borders. You can't really move interest rates very much, even if you have your own currency. And fiscal policy, well, you've now got this huge migration flow. So does that stop that? And we need to have an honest discussion about what does it mean to be national governments. So I think there's a lot of very interesting questions about globalization that we really haven't got to the bottom of. And I think it was a very sad indictment that some people who stood most to lose were willing to gamble in this way, which undoubtedly will leave us worse off if there is Brexit.
Yes, yes. Good. Can we leave you there and come on to Vicky?
Absolutely.
But knowing we'll come back. Vicky, I think it's a bad result if you're a Remainer, which you are.
I lost my credibility completely. I just couldn't see the figures properly.
No, absolutely, absolutely. But we have this gentleman. It's called crowdsourcing. The ESRC approved it. It's called production of knowledge. They love it. We should get a grant off the base of it. Somebody make sure that we have evidence that he did that. The economy, it could go either way. Your observations as an experienced economist.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing so far is that because people were fearing the referendum result, we've seen already quite a substantial slowdown in the economy in 2016. So we had a decline in business investment in the first quarter. We've seen investment intentions going down. We've seen FDI suffering. And we've seen M&A activity suffering. So basically all the indications were that financial markets, investors, businesses generally were fearing very much a result that would lead to leave. And if there were to be a Remain vote, of course, a lot of it will come back in the sense that everything was just being held back temporarily. Mm-hmm. If there isn't one, then obviously this is likely to continue. And of course, if you just look at what happened today and the last few days in terms of the pound going up, equities going up, the shock of a leave now is actually going to be even stronger than would have been felt perhaps if that hadn't happened in the meantime, which means really that the pound probably declined very substantially.
Yeah, we see. It's amazing you're saying that because here's a recovery of your expertise. This presumably is markets elsewhere. Trevor's has come in. We may come to Tony for something on Sunderland or we may not, but do carry on. But that point's vindicated by what's behind you.
Yes.
Carry on, Vicky.
Well, it had been forecast by George Soros earlier in the week, and of course the markets in any case didn't need George Soros to tell them that they were already behaving that way. Every time there was a lead for leave, the pound would drop and the other way around. So that, of course, you know, some people would say that's fantastic for exports, but of course the real problem with the UK is that it imports rather a lot, and what will happen very quickly is that prices will go up. Prices for imported goods that go into manufacturing, so that's going to be a problem for manufacturers, and prices, of course, for consumers who rather buy an awful lot of foreign products. So that's the point. And the other thing, of course, that people will worry about is what sort of trade deal that may be negotiated in the future, how long it will take, and, of course, the expectation that the trade deal we have at present will no longer be the norm, will in itself lead to capital spending and productivity actually suffering in the UK in the longer term. So what we'll be looking for is a much slower growth in the economy from here on, and an increase in unemployment. Almost time for life, but seem to be going and
can,
and down.
Can everybody hear Vicky? Is she? No. I thought perhaps bring us in a bit earlier. And as you do, do you think the scare tactics that were used along the lines of what you're saying were scare tactics, or were they truthful assessments of what would happen in the event of Brexit in economic terms?
Well, we don't know, of course, what will happen, but you just see what's going on with the pound, so that's one of the things that seems to be vindicated. One can only do forecasts on the basis of what's happened before and on the models that one has. And I think there were properly executed models, and I really did believe that they had an awful lot of value in them. The fact that they were not believed or any experts is a bit sad in many ways. And I disagree a little bit with Angus. I think immigration is important, and people are proven to be quite xenophobic. And the interesting thing is also, of course, that they're not really particularly xenophobic where there are loads of immigrants. They seem to be quite concerned about where there aren't any. So the fear factor on the other side, the Leave side, has actually been very significant. Turks coming, everyone coming, and you know, population will increase. They'll take over your schools and hospitals and so on. I think there have been some serious scare tactics on the other side as well.
Thank you very much, and we'll come back to you, Vicky. So you've been already praised here by Angus for this amazing work, which,
like,
to be honest, quite a lot of you don't know what that amazing work was. What's your take on it, both sides, and give us a hint of what the amazing work was, if you know what it was. He may have just made that up.
So I'm going to start with the Brexit scenario, which was that if you look at what the IFS said, what the NISA said, as well as what we said, the basic prediction is that 5 years after Brexit, we would see a 1% to 3% decline in British GDP. If you want to translate that into what that means for the pound in your pocket, that's about £720 per household per year for every 1% decline in GDP. That's the translation. If you want to take a slightly longer view, then it would be essentially about 2 to 8% drop in British GDP. And the reason this would happen would be primarily because trade and investment with our biggest trade partner, which is the European Union, would go down. So that's our prediction. Pretty much all of us agree on that. And I really want to point out here, since there are a lot of journalists in the audience, this is not going to make me popular, but I'm not going to defend macroeconomists. That would be the last thing I want to do. But I do want to point out that it was up to the journalists to put the good economics, to sort of take that and put those numbers in the media rather than the bad economics, which was the 4% of economists who don't agree with these figures and who base their statistics on things like a plastic toy in China is exactly the same as a plastic toy in the UK, and if it's more expensive in the UK, it must be because the regulations are imposing such heavy costs on UK producers. That's an absolutely absurd proposition by most economic standards, but that was what was given. That was where their numbers were coming from, and they were getting much more airtime than any of us ever got. So in that sense, the misinformation that happened, the reason that people in Sunderland think that it was good for them to exit, is really a reflection of that, and I am going to put a personal plug. I did go to Sunderland. I did talk to people there, and what I heard from the city council was, we don't know whether we're going to be Detroit after Brexit or whether we're going to be Pittsburgh. If we're going to be Pittsburgh, essentially, so what if Nissan leaves? We're still going to get on and make something else, and the auto suppliers are going to suddenly start doing major innovations. That was the sort of sentiment. But what they weren't told was that, in fact, the Detroit situation was just much, much more likely. And we tried to tell them, but we just, you know, we can talk to one city council member or a few, but it's really up to the media to do the rest of the job. In terms of what might happen if there is, in fact, a Remain vote, I'm going to end on a happy note, so I'm going to give you the sad news. The sad news is recruitment is frozen at the moment. Mergers and acquisitions, we know, are already down 70% compared to last year. So in that sense, already we're seeing job and investment sort of frozen. If the uncertainty, the political uncertainty persists, if there is a very tight Remain vote even, we're going to see that the political uncertainty isn't going to die tomorrow. In that scenario, when that protracted uncertainty, what that's going to translate into is potentially an economic downturn. And who's going to end up suffering is essentially young college graduates, small businesses, all of these people. So it is going to have real effects on real people, even if there's a close Remain vote. But I'll take a happy stance finally, which is that if there is, in fact, a fairly sort of unequivocal verdict, then what we would see would be we need somebody to take the sort of, you know, positive view that Roy Jenkins took in the 1975 referendum when he said we're going to take an active, constructive, and enthusiastic role in the sort of EU going forward, and we're going to put that uncertainty behind us. Hopefully we can manage to do that depending on the verdict.
Very interesting. Very interesting. We'll have a chance to go back over this.
I'm going to throw something in. One of the subtexts of this referendum is new versus old media. And old media, if there's Remain, have pulled it off. Because the great majority of the papers are Brexit for various commercial reasons of their own.
So it's Leave that pulled it off.
For Leave, excuse me, Leave. And we've heard a lot about, and Mr. Corbyn talks a lot about new media and so on. Well, rumours of its prevalence are greatly exaggerated. If it's still the case that the media set the tone for television reportage, and therefore, getting to the long-winded way of agreeing with you, drive the sort of stuff you were talking about out of the mainstream media and into the world of self-corroborating Twitter, you know? But we'll come back to that perhaps later. We don't have a session on media and power. We did have a session on migration, and we had a very distinguished speaker, and we're weaving migration through the evening rather than having a separate panel on it, and we'll come back to it at the end. Ian, distinguished colleague here at LSE, and now I realise slightly afraid of me, comments, the economy, either way, both on what you've heard, on the results so far, and separately.
Right. What I'm going to try to do, Conor, is give you 5 points, which I'll try to interpret as lessons from and for economics. The first is the Harry Truman point. You heard about Harry Truman, the former US president, who wanted a one-armed economist, so he couldn't say on the one hand or the other hand. And what we've had, very unusually in this economics aspect of the campaign, is an enormous degree of consensus, with one or two rather maverick economists, the famous economists for Brexit, all eight of them, household names, all two of them, saying something different, but the rest of the profession saying there will be a loss of earnings, GDP, jobs for the British economy relative to staying inside the EU. That's the first message that comes over. The second is methodological. Some of the methodologies that have been used are able to be defended because they use accepted approaches. There's a danger of groupthink in this, but I don't think groupthink really has been the phenomenon that we've alleged it to be. And some of the analyses have been slapdash, dishonest, ill-conceived, and lacking in theoretical foundations. The third point is that throughout this campaign, we've been treated to lies, misrepresentations, false statistics being put forward in a way which has really been terribly damaging to the credibility of those using it. Now, let me give you two specific numbers as my fourth point to illustrate this point. Numbers that you've heard endlessly. 350. Anyone recognize that one? 350 million. It's what we're told by Boris Johnson every time he opens his gob, that we are going to save from no longer paying to the European Union. First, the number itself is wrong because it doesn't reflect the reality of what's... Has Conor gone into...
No, go on.
It doesn't reflect the reality of what the budget figures are. The true figure, if you were to measure it correctly, is 280. And it's also irrelevant for a different reason, which is that if GDP falls or rises, all of that difference will be wiped out in any case. False figure, false understanding it. The second figure, you've probably also heard, 4,300. Anyone remember that one? It's the amount that George Osborne told us every household would lose from Britain leaving the EU. Now, what happened there was that the Treasury went through three scenarios with different sets of assumptions. In each of these scenarios, there was a range of potential outcomes. So he took the middle point of the middle scenario and said, here you are, people, that is the one figure you should believe. It's spurious precision, it's dishonest, and it misleads the public. So I think we've had an unfair economic debate in this context. My last point is one which is, if you think about it, blindingly obvious, but completely ignored, which is that you're not, Vicky's not, none of you in the audience is, none of us is average. We all talk about averages all the time, the average impact of immigration, the average effect on the households of changing from one trade regime to another. But when it comes down to you, the individual, you are not average. So if you see your circumstances changing, you don't particularly care that everybody else's are improving. That's what's going to motivate your vote.
The levels of deceit were greater on one side than the other in terms of economic claims?
You notice I meticulously took one from each side.
Yes, I wondered whether that was a spurious search for balance, hiding a real view that one side was preposterously deceitful and the other gamed it a little bit.
I think if you read all the blogs that I've written this, you'll find that both sides were at it as egregious as they possibly could be.
Interesting, interesting, because the Brexit campaign gains from equivalence. And things like the £350 million lie get countered by similar lies from government, and so people think they're all at it. So it's
exactly right.
Politically very beneficial for Brexit. We're going to go, I think, we're going to go to the audience in a minute, question and answer on the economy. At first, I thought it'd be useful to hear from Tony on the implications of Sunderland, Newcastle, the Orkneys, and possibly, if you want to talk about it eccentrically, Gibraltar, and the mystery of the missing Scilly Isle. That's also quite interesting. Tony.
Okay, well, obviously Scilly Isles is counting slightly less fast than Connor was hoping. I mean, interestingly, we've got a very small number of results from Gibraltar, yes, from Newcastle and Sunderland, yes. And on the basis of these, if you remember the figures that I put up earlier this evening about what the cephalological election experts were saying was going on or was likely, they were projecting what would go on if there were a 50-50 result that was showing a particular result for Newcastle and for Sunderland. The ones we've had so far suggest Leave is doing far better than the original opinion polls that we heard from earlier on. Now, there are two possibilities that this could... There are three possible ways for explaining this. One is that the opinion polls might be wrong. I'm not saying that. Don't tweet and quote that. I'm just saying that's a possible explanation. The other is that the projections were calculated in a way that didn't quite capture it for those particular authorities. Or the third possibility is that there is a regional effect that will be balanced by something that's going to happen differently elsewhere. That is, different regions will vote in different ways. But you noticed on this screen earlier on, it did show the pound falling against the dollar. So that's people reacting to the early results. So nothing is definitive. It's very, very early to know what's really happening. These are two or three or four results so far, and we have to wait much, much longer. We may have to wait all the way through till the last results in the morning, I can see now, and certainly well into the night, to know what's actually going to happen. That's it.
Thanks, Tony. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. You can take it away, Tony, actually. Give it to the... very quick, if I had pounds, which I don't, if I had a broker, which I don't, if I had a way of communicating with a non-existent broker to communicate that I wanted to do something to my pounds, should I sell now?
Probably.
No.
No.
No, you should buy pounds now.
Ah, the Newcastle man. The Newcastle Macron. Interesting.
That's an 150 to 143. That's a huge fall on what information?
Good. So it's a good time to buy. Look, that was the sort of thing I wanted to know, pretending I was rich. We have a question here. We have a microphone coming down. Usual rules, if you weren't here earlier. Name, if you'd like, can feel able to give it. And we hope sort of succinct questions or indeed very succinct comments. Sir, get started, and I'll look for one or two others. We have some time. Yeah, good. Go.
My name is Dimitris. I am an alum, and I used to be the chairman of the Greek Student Union of LSE. So the first question has to do with comparison between what people believe that Greece should do, which is to exit the euro so that they can devalue the currency, and the opposite view as far as the pound is concerned, because I understand that if Britain is or were to exit, the pound would be devalued. But I don't seem to get the message that if the pound devalues, there's going to be good for British economy. Whilst people here believe that if Greece were to exit, the devaluation of the Greek currency would be very good for the Greek economy. So this is the first point. The second question is that...
The second and final question.
Yes, of course. I can ask only one if you want.
Go, go. Second and final question.
The second question is, have you taken into consideration the latest forecast by S&P that if Britain is to exit, it would be downgraded, and what would be the implications in the cost of borrowing, and whether this has been taken into consideration in all these models you have gone through?
Thank you. And the chap's going to take your microphone and go up to the man who's returning his hand to the air and is going to give us his name and question. Excellent. Thank you very much, sir.
Hello, Brahim, ELC student in the Master of Political Economy. So my question briefly is, which are the main impact of a Brexit in the M&A market and, of course, maybe also on the foreign direct investment in UK? Thanks.
Thank you. Good man. Very succinct. Is there a final bid for a question?
No.
For a question? Am I missing a face? I am. Sorry. There we are. It's coming down. And then we go back to the panel.
Hi. My name is David Brooks. There's been, irrespective of how the vote goes tonight, how do you think that Europe will react, specifically Germany and France? Will they want, should the UK vote to leave, will they want to make an example out of them to try and deter the Greeks and the Portuguese from leaving as well? Or will they try and accommodate them, even in the case of a Remain vote?
You mean in an economic sense or political sense or a bit of both?
In an economic sense, so when we talk about trade deals and things like that, will they, as Germany has suggested, really try to put them at the back of the queue? Or will they try and be a bit more accommodating?
Yeah, thank you very much for that. We'll take the panel in, I suppose the order we're in, if you don't mind.
Okay, so let me, there was a lot of questions there. Let me try and rattle through a few of them. So Greece, the whole idea of them coming out of the Eurozone was so they could set interest rates where they want to. But now they're already down at a very low level. It's just, from the position they're in, it's all about the degree of debt restructuring that's going on, and when will Europe finally actually accept a write-down in face value, which they can't because that contradicts the treaty. And this is the issue. Almost everybody I've spoken to said, if Europe really wants to reform itself, guess what? You're going to need treaty change. You can't possibly do that because you'll open it up to other people to have remain or stay votes. That is the problem. And Greece is a classic case. The amount of haircuts that Greece has had in its debt by rolling it out, extending the maturity, is a huge write-down, but you can't let off one penny just because of the treaty. So in terms of the euro, you know, people are absolutely right to be so pessimistic. I mean, it was a really... I remember being explained to me about a month ago, somebody who was involved in the banking union. I said, but there's all this risk-sharing in the banking union. And they sort of looked at me and said, Angus, when did you really think there was risk-sharing involved in this? Do you really think it's there? And it was like, oh, my God, well, if you don't have that, you really do have a problem. And it's that lack of trust in those sort of structures which leads people like me to be actually still pretty pessimistic about the structure of that institution. In terms of the downgrade, S&P's downgrading, would that lead to higher borrowing costs? It should lead to higher borrowing, higher credit spread. The borrowing cost, of course, depends on the real interest rate and the credit spread. Whether that actually leads to a total increase in borrowing costs or not, it depends on the relative magnitudes. And if there is a Brexit, because of what we all think it will do to the economy, I actually think that it will be very hard, even if there's a couple of downgrades, for interest rates to go up. Mortgage rates, of course, at the short end of the yield curve, not the long end. And the last one I'll try and deal with tonight about wider Europe, there's a rise of populism. It's not just the UK. It's US. It's cross Europe. This is what I mean. The underlying issues about globalization. We still don't know how to deal with this to make it work for everybody.
Intervening to say, at the last session we had on legal implications, we had the Danish ambassador, very experienced negotiator. I asked the question about legal hindrances to reform, treaties. He said treaties. And that is a real issue in terms of radical transformation. Yeah. Vicky.
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true. And of course, loads of countries have to vote for these changes to take place, which may not happen. And, of course, they all come from different... I mean, this is one of the problems of Europe, but it's something that we've lived with, if you like, for quite some time and lived with it sort of reasonably well. And nobody really wants to have treaty changes either, because indeed there is this danger there. But in terms of relationship with the UK, I mean, it all depends, of course, what, you know, if it is Brexit, what the negotiations might start being, you know, whatever model it is that these people will want. I don't think there is a coherent economic policy of any sort. I don't think there's any agreement as to, you know, what type of relationship they want, and therefore to what extent the Europeans will say yes or no. So it's very difficult to speculate right now. I mean, the May, of course, have said things like, you know, we don't really want to deal, you know, give them any special treatment because everyone else is going to start wanting to leave. But I think there is a real uncertainty there. And I think that is what is going to lead to very slow growth in the UK economy. And you asked about somebody up there about M&A and FDI. We've seen what happened with M&A, which has basically sort of stopped in 2016 so far. And, of course, foreign direct investment has also taken a sort of back step, too. So, if anything, this trend will carry on. If, at the end of the day, whoever runs the country thinks that actually that's rather bad and it's not going to lead to the growth that promised these people from Sunderland and others that it's going to do, then there may be some rethink about what type of trade negotiation we want. So we may well end up down on the Norway route, where we actually do allow all the free movement of people. After all, remember, none of them has now been saying recently that they will be able to control migration, so they will allow possibly all these things to happen, which will actually leave us in a worse position in terms of influence, but at least it will give us the growth that we want.
Thank you. And so, remember, we had four questions, or three questions.
So I can handle the investment and trade deals quickly.
Yeah.
So in terms of investment, those numbers are always going to have much more uncertainty relative to the trade numbers, because we have much better trade data and the statistics, we can be much more confident about which way the relationship would go. But we can still go ahead and use historical investment data, see what EU membership, what effects it has had in the past. And from that, our prediction is that it's going to be a 20% decline in British in FDI coming into Britain, forever on. I mean, it's just going 20% down forever on. And that would not be made up for even if we did some kind of European free trade agreement, because these free trade agreements typically are much more restricted. They cover trade, but not really investments, or they cover trade in goods, but not really trade in services. In terms of sort of trade deals, the speculation is that I think it's going to be very unlikely that the European Union, in fact, gives us a very good deal after we sort of exit and then try and renegotiate, primarily because it can set off a domino effect. What stops the French and the Dutch and the Danish and the Swedish to now go back and start renegotiating? And then the whole process starts to unravel.
Thank you. Ian.
Well, a further comment on the Greek position first. For Greece, exit from the euro would be a calamity, because Greece lacks an export sector other than tourism and shipping. And the idea that somehow Greece can price itself back into a successful economy through massive devaluation, it would be massive. It would be 50%, it would be instant inflation, it would be calamitous. Let's be clear on that. The British economy is very different from that, because a moderate devaluation of the pound could be beneficial to certain exports. But even with certain exports, the British economy has these days manufacturing accounting for around 10% of the economy. In the London area, it's about 3%. The big areas of future exports are services. So that's a transformation we have to be aware of. On two other questions, talk about Ibrahim's question about M&A or foreign direct investment coming into the UK. There are two things to say about it. One is that we can be reasonably clear, for the reason that Swati has given, about the direction. It's going to be negative. Where there's far more uncertainty is the magnitude. So you need to separate magnitude from direction. Negative, but maybe not that negative. I think she exaggerates a bit in some of her models, but that's a methodological dispute we can have forever. Now, on the question of changes, will the rest of the EU try to gain revenge on Britain? I think that's implicit your question. There's one economist principle, maybe political economy principle, you really ought to consider: incentives. What is the incentive to kick each other in the teeth? There probably isn't one. So the incentive will be to deal with the uncertainty quickly, to try to arrange things as rapidly as possible, rather than saying, well, you walked away, so we're going to get revenge on you. That's not how it works.
The four of you in the panel, Swati, I think you're probably too young. I don't know. Were you all in favour of Britain joining the euro? Hands up, hands up. Who was in favour of Britain joining the euro? Yeah. Because this is my last point, for you to react to if you choose. A devastating critique of economic experts has been, ha-ha, they wanted us to join the euro. Ha-ha. And that has done enormous damage to authority.
But they were lying about that. Yes, I think I disagree. I mean, I had completely forgotten about Ian and the euro. Now I understand where he was coming from. I really do think that there's been an attack on experts on that basis, and loads of lies said about who supported the euro before. And the interesting thing to me is also the attack on people who forecast and got things wrong. It is quite likely, of course, that, in fact, it's quite true that forecasters do get things wrong. But they have been forecasting for a long time. I've been learning from their mistakes. One side to say, they got things wrong and therefore we can't trust them at all in the future, they haven't demonstrated any right forecasts of their own. So I actually think it was completely biased in one way. And I don't agree with Ian at all about this £4,300 thing. There was a range shown in the Treasury. The fact that they decided to talk about that is a different issue. But if you look at what the OECD said, what the IMF has said, and almost what the National Institute has said under various assumptions on productivity for the longer term, it actually isn't very different to what the Treasury said. So we've got to bear in mind that...
Vicky, I did say there's a consensus.
Yes, but you decided to choose that 4,300 and say that actually that was also just as bad as a 350. Spurious precision, that's a different issue, but 350 is a lie, whereas 4,300 is a spurious precision, which is slightly different in terms of the magnitude of the mistake.
So if a student says something wrong, I'll say you're spuriously precise,
exactly,
which is less bad than saying you're a bloody liar. Angus wants to come in.
Yeah,
and then Swati, who will remind us, you will not need to correct me on the euro, and I apologise.
Okay, just a couple of points on this. The problem with the 4,300 figure is they took GDP and divided it by the number of households. Now, households don't get GDP. Businesses are in that figure as well. So they should really have looked at the income. So that's what, and you could almost see Osborne getting too close, saying, oh, it's close enough, we'll just use that figure and put it out that way. So it was unfortunate because, again, the Treasury just sort of couldn't help itself. In the Scottish referendum, it did exactly the same. That said, I think economists, when they make these forecasts, frankly, you know, apart from getting the direction right and a sense of the magnitude, I think everything else can't be told, because it's about holding the rest of the world constant, and it never stays that way. Much more compelling is that the economists get the argument right, and I think in this case the economists all told the same argument, and that was much more important than the actual number. If I can just say on the euro, we put out a research paper on the impact of Brexit on low-income households. Within about 2 hours, there's a press release out about us and myself about how we campaigned for Britain joining the euro, which I wasn't even in the country for. But the other kids were at school, so you know, straight away it was rubbish. But, you know, we should grow up and get used to it. The same thing happened in the Scottish referendum. I had exactly the same thing. So it's par for the course. You just have to make sure your analysis is right and stick to the point.
Thank you. Swati, and then you might want to come in here, but Swati, and sure. Very briefly, I'm afraid.
So that was exactly the point I was going to raise. We got the same sort of allegations that we supported the euro. Clearly, two of us were in high school when that happened. We didn't support the euro. So this was completely lies.
Thank you. Ian, have you a last word?
Last word, dangerous for me. I was recently on a panel discussion on BBC News Channel where the BBC very deliberately said, I was the neutral voice. And the Leave campaigner said, yes, but LSE gets money from the European Union, therefore you can't be neutral.
Yes.
Oh, that is a dispiriting but very interesting last word.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's the Isles, I now see plural. The Isles of Scilly have voted to remain. So yet another place we weren't sure was in, have voted to remain within what we didn't know they were in. I'm being rude about the Isle of Scilly. They voted to remain. I don't think it adds too many. We have run out of other things, but we do have the library exhibition still on. Is that right? From the 1975 referendum, which is in the Alumni Theatre, which is sort of over there. So you've got something you can do in the drinks break.
which begins now and ends...
There's somebody desperate to ask you a question.
I know, but I'm resisting it, aren't I? Because these good people want to take this five-minute break before they come back for what could be a key session, which is the UK and Europe, what will change. And, ladies and gentlemen, we have the Irish ambassador, a very late guest. Very, very important. Ireland, borders, extraordinary. He's coming in, Mr. Mulhall, joining the rest of the panel, Quentin and Lewis. So that's in about 5 minutes. So do take a break and come back, and we'll go to TV.
60.
Swindon.
The
Swindon.
Number of votes cast in favour of remain a member of the European Union was 51,220. The number of votes cast in favour of leave the European Union was 61,745. The number of ballot papers rejected was as follows. Both answers voted for, 33. Writing or marked by which the voter could be identified, 5. Unmarked or void for uncertainty, 57. And the total number of ballot papers rejected was 95. Thank you.
Swindon 61,745, leave 51,220 remain. You can read that on the screen there. And the leave side is 55%, 45% for remain. And I think, Jeremy, that's pretty much in line, Swindon, isn't it, with what you were expecting, or what you and John Curtis were expecting from Swindon. Do you want to just take us through where you've got to?
Yeah, well let's compare it to the Sunderland result, because when Sunderland and Newcastle came in, the shock of that in this studio, because Leave had done so much more and so dramatically better than our index suggested or our knowledge of those two counting areas suggested. So we're now seeing it stabilise a little more. We are in for a long night here. There's no question about that. So let me just show you, first of all, Sunderland. Let's just remind ourselves of where Sunderland is. Now, the midway point on our index is where you'd expect it to be a 50-50 result, if the result across the nation is 50-50. Here we see Sunderland into Leave territory, but not by much. And let's remind ourselves of the Sunderland result here and how dramatic it was for Leave. So you see a more than 20% gap for Leave in Sunderland. So that's a better performance for Leave than we might have expected in Sunderland. But now we have Swindon. Let's have a look at Swindon. So if you look at the algorithms that we used and we were talking about earlier, this analysis that we did of these counting areas based on how many pensioners who tend to vote out, how many graduates who tend to vote in, ethnic minority voters, UKIP voters in 2014, etc. You put together all those factors, we ended up with Swindon as a more Eurosceptically inclined area than Sunderland. So it looked to us like Swindon would vote even more for Leave. But that result has come in like this. And you can see the margin is much closer. So it's 55 for Leave and 45 for Remain. Now that's what we would have expected based on Swindon's position on the index. So Sunderland and Newcastle might be outliers here. Maybe there's something going on with the voting in the North of England. But it's all getting very, very interesting on our board. There's no way of even starting to call it, David.
We have a result in from Broxbourne. This is our first home county's result, Broxbourne in Hertfordshire. UKIP had some success in the local elections, and this is the result in Broxbourne. 33,700. Leave, 17,000 remain. That's 66% for Leave and 34% for Remain. And we're joined now by Nick Robinson, who suddenly turned up on his way. Nick, what are you doing tonight? You're going from north to south through the night. Is that right?
We started in Edinburgh, David, at the polling station there in the middle of the evening. Been to Newcastle, here in Sunderland, on my way to Leeds any second, then to Peterborough, trying to see and to paint a picture of a divided nation, because I think what is so striking about what we're seeing tonight is a divided nation, divided by nations themselves, Scotland v England, of course, divided by region, divided by class, divided by educational background. I think these results suggest, as Jeremy was just saying, that that is what's going on. Meeting here in Sunderland, it may help explain a little bit of what Jeremy was saying about the difference between results here in the North East and in Swindon there in the south, is that I was hearing from people on the Leave and the Remain camps here, there are people in this town who have not voted, in this city, not voted since 1983, not voted, in other words, since the days of Margaret Thatcher, who came out, as they put it, and this was people on both sides, to kick the establishment. People who left their houses for the first time to vote, they wanted to kick not just Brussels, they wanted to kick David Cameron, they wanted to kick the establishment, I was told, they wanted to kick the bankers, they pretty much wanted to kick anybody they could, and they believed that voting Leave was the way to do that.
What's your view of the way that it's gone so far?
Well, what intrigues me is whether this becomes a pattern, or what we actually see is the mounting up of votes in working class areas where there's a revolt against the establishment for Leave, but equally a mounting up of votes for Remain in urban metropolitan areas with a younger demographic. That's why I think it's much too early to tell whether this Sunderland result, that early sign at Newcastle as well, is giving us a national picture, or merely suggesting that this great gulf between the different voters is even greater than we realise. That, in other words, I was hearing from a whole series of senior Labour figures that in recent days, votes had hardened up amongst what you might call rather patronisingly Guardian readers, metropolitan, liberal, younger, professional classes, people in the public sector, had hardened up for Remain. Now, we may not see that until we see the vote in those urban areas later on. But when you're seeing votes in the smaller towns, the towns that are often described by sophologists, as the left behind, people with high working class populations, what you're seeing there instead is, in fact, a mounting up of votes for Leave, because they want to kick someone, and the opportunity to do it was to vote against the establishment and to vote for Leave.
Where are you going to pop up next, Nick?
Leeds is my next stop.
Look forward to seeing you.
A couple of hours from now.
Thank you very much. See you there. There's something interesting about the London turnout. There was vile weather in London today. The roads were flooded, the trains weren't working, the underground wasn't working, there was all hell let loose. And John, you think that there's been an actual effect on the London, which was expected to be very heavily Remain, wasn't it? But it's had an effect on the vote in London.
Well, perhaps certainly the 7 or 8 boroughs that now have told us what their level of turnout is, given what's been going on in the rest of the country, we would have expected around a 2 to 3 point higher turnout in these boroughs than has actually been reported. Now, maybe it's the weather, maybe it's not, but whatever is the cause, given that London is indeed one of those places that was expected to be relatively strongly for the Remain side, if this is correct, it's another little bit of bad news for the Remain side that, so far as turnout is concerned, again, the numbers may not be working quite as much in its direction as it was hoping.
I mean, the truth is, there hasn't been any good news for the Remain side yet, has there, this evening?
Well, that's a slight exaggeration. I think the truth is, for example, that in Orkney and in Clackmannanshire, the result was pretty much in line with what we were expecting. It wasn't too far off in Broxford. So we've had some places where the outcome's been much closer to what we might think expecting a 50-50 result. Newcastle and Sunderland so far really stand out. I think what perhaps the Remain side might worry about is the only place that's really coming better for them than we were expecting was the Isles of Scilly. And of course, the Isles of Scilly is the smallest of all of the counting units that we've got tonight.
Not to forget Gibraltar. Thanks, John. Well, I think only 800 people voted to leave. Emily.
We're here with Tim Montgomery and Alistair Campbell again. Tim, what are your team captains saying after results in Sunderland and Swindon, all looking very positive for Leeds?
Certainly those results are looking positive for Leeds, but perhaps the most interesting thing is the turnout. You're seeing, just as John Curtis was explaining, in London, in Northern Ireland, in Scotland, lower turnouts, whereas in the Leave areas, like some of the places we've seen in the North East and the home counties, the turnout is much greater. It seems to be the case that, as a lot of people expected, those that want to leave the European Union have always been more enthusiastic. And despite the weather, despite obstacles, they've turned out. So if this is true, we should still be very cautious, but this could be a much better night for Leave than many of us were expecting a couple of hours ago.
So Kate Homey said in the last few moments that Labour could end up losing thousands of voters over issues like immigration. I wonder if you think that the EU has become a proxy.
I won't turn the glass, but you are on top of it.
Lives, that divided country.
Well, I certainly think, and this is the danger of referendums, I don't think this referendum is just about Europe and the European Union. I think a lot of the people like will have been turning against in this debate, particularly in a lot of what are seen as traditionally Labour areas. Are people who just feel that the financial crisis happened and the people who caused it got away with it and they didn't? They feel that there's too much division, there's too much inequality, that all they've had from this government, they talk about this great economic miracle, is actually austerity, austerity, austerity. And they're basically saying two fingers to the lot of you.
But Labour knew all that, didn't they? I mean, Labour's known this for years now. They saw the vote disappearing in the northeast of UKIP.
And I also think that the Labour Party has to understand that we can't just sort of keep on with banging on the same old messages that have come out through this campaign. I think this is about the Labour Party has to be really careful about this, because, and I said to you earlier, one is this is not over, and secondly, I'm really worried about this just becoming about the Tory party and the Tory party leadership. There's a real danger for Labour here as well, and we have to face up to the fact that large parts of the country are actually turning away from both of the main parties. And I think this referendum has unleashed all sorts of stuff. It's why I always thought it was a bad idea to have it. And that sounds arrogant. Don't let the people decide.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
It doesn't sound arrogant.
No, I don't think it is arrogant. No, I don't.
Insult the people. No, such can. A fundamental issue like this.
I've met after so 40 many people. Years. I've met so many people around the place in the last few weeks saying, you've seen them in agony. Having to make decisions that ultimately, I think, I want politicians to be elected and then lead. And we're in this position because of a lack of leadership and a lack of strength.
Well, when you look at the leadership, every single leader except one has been on the Remain side.
Yeah, and I think Jeremy Corbyn gave a gift to the Leave campaign on Sunday when he said there was no upper limit on immigration from the European Union. And Alistair is right about the austerity factor, the fact there is a global revolt against the existing capitalist system. But I think Labour have underestimated how concerned the working class vote is about the lack of control over immigration.
More concerned than that, Tim, you and I have looked at that graph of the pound literally falling off a cliff.
Yeah.
Not literally, but falling off a cliff. Factoring in a 40% leave tomorrow.
But people look at that and then think this is just markets making money. So, you know, we've given this kind of, the bookies and the markets have been telling us what's going to happen.
So the economic argument got through.
No, the economic argument, I think, did get through. But for a lot of these people, they heard everybody talking about, we're going to lose this great economic success that we've got, but they're not feeling that economic success now.
And also, you know, these are the same people who, remember the Queen's famous question to the Economist? Why didn't you see the crash happen? You know, we've had the Economist and the establishment wrong about Iraq war, wrong about regulation of Wall Street, wrong about immigration.
So Michael Gove was right to say the British public don't need
Well, there is a problem. They need political leaders. There is a problem we have at the moment is that those powers that be, those established authorities, aren't trusted by at least half of the country.
Thank you both very much. David.
Andrew Eagle, you were listening to what was being said up there, and we've got John McDonald saying about Sunderland that people have cheesed off, migration is a big issue. Has Labour lost touch with its core voters?
Well, clearly, there are people for whom life is really tough. And
they're your people?
Yes. And life has been made tougher by the decisions that the Conservative government nationally has made.
So they should turn to you?
Particularly the...
I have Dan, I have you as three. Brenton, we have you as number one, is that okay? Or Lewis, we have you as number one.
Yeah.
Lewis, you as number two. Yeah. Now, could I put Trudeau.
Sure. Where do you want me to sit?
It doesn't matter, actually. It doesn't matter. Are you Louis or Lewis?
Lewis.
Lewis.
Yeah.
Because, Quentin, you're starting. Maybe if you sit over there, then Lewis, then Dan.
Okay, fine, yeah.
And the way it's
I'll be staying very
okay.
Long.
Okay.
Quick presentation.
Yes.
Conversation. Yes. If anything comes up here, I'll break. You know, it's the last session.
So we're like this?
Yeah.
Ugh. But you introduce it, you can say, if possible, I'm a professor of economics and management here, but I'm running the economic policy for Ciudadanos, and I've been campaigning in Spain all day today, will be campaigning tomorrow. So I have, I'm doing politics as well, so it kind of gives a bit of context.
Which party?
Ciudadanos.
Right, guys, I think we're nearly there. Mild congratulations to those of you who are still here, which is, of course, all of you who hear me. At the LSE election night.
Yes, sure, sure.
Various romances were born at this point in the evening. One, bottles of wine were brought in. And so this is the romantic end of the evening. Now, this is, regrettably, because of the controls imposed by the European Commission, blame it on everything. But seriously, we've decided this is the last session. But we're going to keep the building open afterwards. So when Kevin has said his goodbyes, Kevin Featherstone, whose department's put on this marvellous event, we'll stay, and you're welcome to stay, but we will be literally throwing you out of the building at about 2:45. Because security have been amazing, and LSE has been very accommodating, but we want them to know that they can go home at 3 o'clock. It's fair enough. It's fair enough. This is a really critical session. It's on a knife edge. And we literally do not know what is going to happen. And we have UK and Europe, what will change? I suppose you could put it, if anything, as we do in law exams. And we have a great cast. Quentin is here. Danuta couldn't come. Was drawn away at the last minute. These things happen. And Lewis is going to be number two. Lewis is involved very closely in the politics of the economy in Spain, written up in today's or yesterday's newspaper as a potential model in some respects for the UK. So he's got a close connection with the politics as well as the economics. And Dan, who's here on my immediate left and is a late addition to the list, is the ambassador from the Republic of Ireland, whose Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, has made two visits to the United Kingdom, and various ministers have come as well in efforts to get out, if I may say so, the vote. I think there's been a very clear position. So we have a really excellent spread here, and the question they're addressing, and it's still hypothetical, what will change if in, what will change if out? And the usual rules, chaps, we start with 5 or 6 minutes maybe, I'll hold you to it, we'll have a conversation, and then we move into a Q&A. And we aim to end this one somewhere around 1:45. Quentin, Chatham House, away you go.
Not Chatham House rules.
No, we're not the Chatham House rule.
Good. Connor, thank you very much. Is the microphone okay? Can everybody hear me? It does strike me that we've been given a pretty cruel and unnatural fate to be this final panel in the early hours of the morning, just as things are starting to get really quite interesting. So
people should yell if there's any interesting.
Yes, shut up. We want to listen to the television. Anyway, okay, answer the question. What will change? Well, if it's Brexit, it's clearly very dramatic. If it's Remain, huge relief. And then, okay, some real soul-searching. And I think that soul-searching will actually be as much about the real crises going on as it is about the populist backlash as revealed by the British referendum campaign. That's to say, all those things that were there before David Cameron threw his little bomb into the ring, the refugee crisis, the Eurozone crisis, dealing with Russia. And those will come straight back onto the agenda. But let me start with Brexit and how I see that playing out. And I apologize if I'm going over some of the ground you've been over in previous sessions, but actually I wasn't able to be here for all of that. But I mean, the first thing I would say with the Brexit is a very real danger of financial meltdown like tomorrow. I mean, at 5:30 a.m., as I understand it, there is a conference call by all the major stock exchange regulators to all the major finances to say, if it's Brexit, what do you think is going to happen and how are we going to control this? And that financial reaction, which clearly we'll see, and you heard it at the last panel, in a very sharp reduction in sterling and a slump in the stock exchange and a very possible knock-on effect on the other European currencies and exchanges, would come very quickly. And when I was talking to my friends in Berlin a couple of months ago and saying, well, how are you going to react, this and that, their initial reaction was, I think that the financial markets will punish the British. And 1 month ago, they started to say, the trouble is, I think they'll punish us too, so maybe we need to do something about this. But what you're going to have is a very swift financial reaction and a very confused and rather slow political reaction. And the two actually are out of kilter. Because the first thing on the political front, at least traditionally that what is said, and I'm sure Dan can confirm in the cases of Irish referendums, is what do you mean by no? Brussels will say to a British government, what do you mean by this vote? And I'm not sure there's going to be a very coherent British government to answer that question, because the very first thing is, how long will Cameron survive and who will replace him? And can that person who replaces him then command a majority in the House of Commons, or will there be an election? So in Britain, you will have an extended period of political uncertainty before a UK government can go to Brussels and say, this is what it means, this is what we want. Do we go for Article 50, and what does that imply? Okay, let's assume that after 6 months they do go to Article 50, bearing in mind all the time that in the background this financial meltdown may well not have been resolved. Anyway, you then have a two-year period of negotiating the very narrow formalities of exit. Because what's, I think, been blended in all of this in much of the debate here is that isn't the negotiation on the future relationship.
We're going to stop you for a minute because we have some action. West Dunbartonshire.
And West Dunbartonshire, 16,400, 26,794. And this is slightly better for Remain, share 38% and 62% there for Remain. So I'm joined now by Alex Salmond, the Scottish National Party MP for Gordon in the House of Commons, formerly the leader.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Carry on, sorry.
Yep.
Now you know what to say. Everything changed.
Everything's changed. So confusion on the British front. Not sure what they're going to do. Do they apply for Article 50? Yes, okay, then it's 2 years. And only after that do we start to negotiate, as a country outside the European Union, what our future relationship is. So the potential for a very prolonged period of uncertainty, but I guess 8 years, something like that, before any clarity emerges. Included in that is the huge question hanging over the financial markets, City of London, about what happens to the whole passporting system. So the people I've been talking to in the City of London are talking about having to make not just what Andrea Leadsom says, sticking up a brass plate in Luxembourg for £250, no, actually establishing very substantial banking operations within the EU and the Eurozone in order to carry on operating. They can't do it from a London base. So all of that is happening. Okay, the political uncertainty on the European side, on the EU side, clearly the danger of a domino effect. If I might run through that very quickly. Okay, Denmark, the Netherlands, Sweden, Italy, Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, all of them could see demands for referendums. It's not clear that they would get them, and it's not clear that they would be referendums about membership. I think in Denmark, Danish People's Party would demand a referendum on membership or something like that. They can't get it unless they have a majority in Parliament, and there's no guarantee they would have a majority in Parliament. The Netherlands, Geert Wilders, will almost certainly push for a referendum there. The interesting quirk about the Dutch system is you can only have a referendum on a new proposal. And leaving the European Union is not a new proposal. So actually, it's not clear what the definition of that would be. And Italy's the other one, which we heard the other day at the QE2 Centre when we had our last conference about this. The Italian constitution forbids a referendum on an international treaty. So actually, you cannot have a referendum on an international treaty under the Dutch system. So none of those are actually a sort of no-brainer, yes, there'd be a referendum. And as for the East Europeans, Czech Republic, Hungary or Poland, I simply don't think politically any of them are seriously going to put on the agenda leaving the European Union. So there is a danger of a domino effect, but not an absolutely clear process. I think the European Union would survive a Brexit. What it wouldn't survive would be a French exit. And the French political situation with Marine Le Pen, absolutely critical. And the question is, and this is why France, I think, would take a very tough attitude to any British renegotiation, is would a Brexit hugely encourage Marine Le Pen and the National Front in France? Because if she, God forbid, ever got near actually winning that presidential election, France pulling out of the whole thing or France unstitching the whole thing would be a disaster.
Which means Germany would support France, which means the two big players would have an interest in punishing Britain in the course of the 2 years that it said there'd be further negotiations. Would
I
that be
think
fair?
There would be a very different emphasis between the two. I think the Germans are so worried about the knock-on effect economically as well as politically that they would be trying to balance, if you like, yes, a tough negotiation, but not such a tough negotiation that it would be outright punishment.
Yes.
It would clearly be a less good deal than just hanging on inside the internal market. Shall I switch very quickly to the thoughts of Remain, which are not very profound? So much journalists find it much more interesting to talk about real drama like Brexit, which I desperately in my heart don't want to happen, than Remain. Well, one, is Cameron going to be stronger? Is he going to be an engaged player? Hey, this man has had, you know, mortal civil war within his party. His absolute priority is going to be to try and hold the party together, which means that he's going to have to carry on making endless concessions to Eurosceptics. Otherwise, he'd lose his party and lose his power. So I don't think it's going to be any dramatic change in Cameron's attitude. So his first priority to heal the party. Okay, there is sympathy for, clearly he's very keen on the sort of economic reform process, competitiveness, all of those things that are already in the system. And I think he'd get support on that. But come back to the immediate crises, refugees, Eurozone, Russia. Will Cameron really do something to help on any of those fronts? I mean, if I were Angela Merkel, I'd be saying to him, you know, David, what are you now going to do for me? I've done, you know, they've kept a lid on these things through the referendum process. And I'm not sure that Cameron has got a lot to offer. I think as far as refugees are concerned, he could do significantly more boosting Frontex and the external border security system, but I doubt he's going to do much more in taking lots more refugees. It's just, you know, he's going to be punished on that. So I just don't, I think I'll leave it there.
Leave it there, because we can come back. We can come back.
No, no, that's fine.
And that's a very, very good introduction. Lewis, it's a Spanish experience, obviously, for you, but more generally, and in your capacity as a prof here, too.
Right.
It's UK and Europe, that's what will change?
Right. I'll do a tiny introduction on Spain, because I think it's interesting in this context. So we have an election in Spain on Sunday. There are four parties. There's the traditional right and left party, and then there is Podemos, which is like Syriza, and there's Ciudadanos, which is center party. I'm running the economic and social policy for that party. So I was today campaigning in Bilbao, and I will be tomorrow campaigning, or what is today, in Valladolid. So I'm basically off. You haven't seen me for a while here, and I actually officially on unpaid leave. So
all right, don't justify yourself too much.
Don't worry.
You're gonna smell a rat here.
So the reason I'm pointing this out is because we've been concerned with populism and with the populism backlash, and the fact that so many electorates in so many countries feel bent on self-destruction. And we just narrowly avoided self-destruction in Austria, just barely. And we don't know if we will avoid it in the USA with Trump. And we basically just watching self-destruction maybe appear tonight in the UK. And it's kind of strange. I mean, you just feel that there are a lot of people who feel they got nothing to lose. And when you tell them, look, it's going to be much worse, they're like, so what? It's already much worse. And that really is something that we all have to worry about. I mean, I as a part-time politician, I guess, but everybody in the Western world. I'll come back to it in 3 minutes when I do the strict international stuff. First, international consequence of stay. I think Europe is really, really, really determined to make leave is leave a real serious statement. So Quentin is right that the temptation, the European temptation to fudge is always there. And I, as a once, many years ago, a Eurocrat, I already feel the stirrings in my belly of like, well, maybe we can just offer something to the UK that looks like leave but isn't leave. But that just can't be, right? I mean, the Europeans say leave is leave because they feel like, look, if you're going to have your cake and eat it, a lot of people are going to want that. You can not contribute to the EU and not have freedom of movement and not apply the regulations and yet have access to a single market, which is what basically the Leave camp would want. That's just not going to happen. So that means to me, and I don't know if Quentin would agree with that means to me a very acrimonious divorce. A divorce in which one of the parties has promised to get is essentially impossible for the other party to deliver. Impossible. We can't just, as a European, I would not stand for it, and I don't think the Poles would stand for it, etc. I don't think we can stand for a country that gets a deal where they have access to the internal market and they get all these other things just off their plate, which means what they want and what Europe is willing to concede is not possible, which means very acrimonious, really skyrocketing, stupid, silly battles to show that you're really committed to this course of action, and the other one also wants to show the commitment, so we all kind of queue in Heathrow for hours and hours or things like that. Who knows what? That, to me, is the biggest risk. The second thing that I would say, I agree with Quentin on that. The uncertainty and the meltdown risk is there for sure. Because when you talk to officials, and I've talked to officials from the European Central Bank recently, from other of the institutions about this, and basically what you hear all the time is, oh, have you planned for this, like Quentin said? Have you planned for this, like, no. Have you planned for a settlement system? No. Have you planned, is it going to be, how is it going to change? I don't think there's really a contingency plan for a Brexit in terms of the finance and the economics. Not for the trade, of course, but I mean also for the nitty-gritty of the financial markets. And third, contagion. I disagree there. Well, maybe I agree because he went around. And I actually don't think there's going to be referendum contagion. I think it's much more Europe fatigue. I think, to me, the big contagion is more like the king is naked kind of contagion. It's like, for a few years, we already all noticed that the elites are heading ahead with Europe, and people in Europe are like, what the hell? I mean, what is this Europe for? And for me, the bigger contagion is more that countries like Holland and like Austria and like Denmark and so on are going to be putting brakes on every single action that looks like more federalism. I mean, you know what Rutte says, Mark Rutte says every time he's asked. He's like, I don't want to hear of any single step forward until France starts reforming. And you can bet that's a condition that is going to take a while to happen, at least by Mark Rutte's standards. So I think what I see more in terms of contagion is a really bad time for Europe. Finally, I wanted to go back. I'm not going to consider Remain because I think the Remain case is actually pretty good. The Remain case is one where we've seen how bad things can get, and we start to head in the good direction. I think it's the first time since I live in the UK already for 8 years that I hear people actually making a case for Europe. So I'm glad with that. So I won't talk about Remain, but I do want to talk back to the start about the backlash, about the fact that the populist backlash, the fact that in so many countries, so many people feel they have no stake in the established order. We are all here, we are all going to LSE, and we have good jobs, and we fly around the world. And we think globalization is great, and trade is great, and technology is great. And we don't see those people who are seeing things that we don't even know. I mean, we don't even respect sometimes people who feel, or foreigners something, they feel their life is under threat. We don't know what it means. And I can't claim to have sympathy for that because I don't understand it. But if we don't have an answer to that, to their feeling about migration and about trade, I think we're gonna have much more trouble. Of course, we want to protect our way of life. So I won't say that I have an answer. In Spain, what we did with Ciudadanos is, I think it's the only radical centrist reform party that has come out of the crisis. We offer people a solution that says, look, there are these guys in Podemos offering you stop the train of globalization, you can get out. We don't think you can get out. We are going to offer you, let's take advantage of globalization, let's do training, let's do education, let's do better labor markets, better good markets, etc., goods markets. And yeah, you do have some tractions. We get 15% of the vote, a little bit more next Sunday. But at the end of the day, there is a very substantial share of the population in Spain, in Greece, in France, in Austria, in the US, in the UK, I mean, Netherlands, places which are completely happy. I mean, when I'm in the Netherlands with my friends, my kids live there, I spend some of my time there. It's a perfect country. It's complete paradise. There's no crime. There's no social conflict. The economy is perfect. There's no unemployment. There's no nothing. I mean, just nothing that you can see it's bad happens in the Netherlands.
Footballers didn't get into the European Championship. The footballers didn't get into the
football is bad. And that's good for us because we can claim some revenge for Spain. But they are depressed. They complain all the time. The Dutch people are completely depressed. And you're like, what are you depressed about? So I don't have... There's probably a Dutch person in the audience who can give us a better psychoanalyst than I can. You agree there's nothing to...
There's a happy Dutch
depressed.
Guy.
You're depressed.
A happy Dutch guy who left
but
the Netherlands.
But you're depressed or happy?
He looks ecstatic still to be in another country.
Yeah, you're drinking beer. Okay, that's it for the first one, and we'll continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll come back to a number of those points. There's themes that are evoked from previous sessions that have returned. An indirect impact of globalization is certainly one that we need to think about. A second occurred to me is our voting system actually has protected the governing classes from knowing about this because they've disciplined the communities that are generating MPs by the first-past-the-post system. Dan, Irish ambassador, it shares a border with the United Kingdom. It's too close to call either. What on earth is going to happen?
Well, of course... As a diplomat, as an ambassador, I do not have a crystal ball, and the practice of diplomats, a very sensible one, is to wait until the facts are established and then wait until our Prime Minister or the government in the morning, presumably in the morning, makes a statement, and then I will take my line from that and I will loyally represent the Irish position when it's established.
We won't tell anybody.
No, it's a half one. It's half one. Damn. It's half one.
What I can say is that you know, the topic here is you know, the future of the European Union and so forth, right? I've been around this track now for about 35 years, right? And I haven't been working on European Union affairs all the time. I've had two postings in Asia. I've had a posting in Scotland as Consul General, and I've had a posting in Brussels and so forth. And I also headed up the European Union division for 4 years in Dublin, and I went through two referendum campaigns in Dublin on the Lisbon Treaty. So I kind of feel that if you want to imagine the future, you should look at the past. And generally speaking, the future is a continuation of, to some extent, of the past, with certain things changing and evolving. And my experience of the European Union has been its capacity to adapt has been quite formidable, really, throughout my career, in that I started off, remember, when the first phrase I ever heard about the European Union was eurosclerosis. And that was back in the 1970s when there was a perfectly formed organization but wasn't doing very much. And then I was in Brussels during the Delors era, and I remember the great excitement at that time of the, you know, the Maastricht Treaty and all of that. And so, and then if you look at the Eurozone crisis and the way in which the European Union or the Eurozone managed to deal with a situation that hadn't been anticipated when the treaties were first written and the kind of things that were done. So my conclusion from my experience is that the European Union works best when it's challenged, when it's under challenge. And, for example, I remember very well when the Berlin Wall came down. There wasn't glorious enthusiasm for that development, by the way. There was wariness. There was worry about could Europe cope with a situation where Germany might become a reunited nation. Well, here we are 25 years after those events, and Germany is a united nation and a significant player, probably the most significant player within the European Union. So I suppose my point is that the European Union has shown itself over the decades of my experience to be quite good at adjusting. When it comes to Ireland, we have a special position, if you like, with regard to this referendum now, which has come to an end, and votes being counted, in that I was probably one of only a very small handful of ambassadors here who actually spoke publicly and articulated our government's position, which was that we wanted the UK to remain in the European Union because of the nature of our relationship, the unique nature of our relationship with the UK. Just one fact I would give you is that there was an opinion poll done by the European Movement in Ireland there a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and it asked people, what's your view of the European Union? And even in a situation following the Eurozone crisis and the effects that had on Ireland, happily now our economy is growing, grew last year nearly 8%. But the opinion polls showed a remarkable level of support for the European Union in Ireland, even if Britain were to leave the Union.
I want to go to Tony in a minute. I want to ask you, I know you don't want to answer this question, but Tony Blair and John Major went to Northern Ireland, and there have been explicit warnings about a collapse of the Good Friday Agreement as a result of this, a rebuilding of walls. You mentioned the Berlin Wall. Are you, forget the fact you're an ambassador for a minute, you're an experienced public servant.
I'm afraid
servant.
I can't can. Forget that fact.
You can.
You may be able to forget the fact that you're an academic, but I can't forget the fact that I'm an ambassador.
Barely remember what I am. I think I've got the answer before I pose the question. The end of free movement between Britain and Ireland, there since this formation of the state. We suffer catastrophically, do we not, from Brexit. I'm an Irishman as well.
Wait until the morning and you'll see what the situation is and what the response of the Irish government will be. Don't ask me to try and predict the future. I'm not very good at that kind of thing, I discovered.
That's why he's 35 years and a successful ambassador. We're going to go to Tony Quinn.
As a man who's married to an Irish wife, I must admit I'm disappointed your government hasn't been more forthright on the absolutely catastrophic effect on Ireland of a Brexit. I mean, end of the Good Friday Agreement, like that. I mean, everything that it stood on will be cut away from under it, and the economic effect will be absolutely disastrous.
Well, I think our government has actually spoken quite clearly. Our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Charlie Flanagan, has spoken quite a number of times, making his case, arguing or making the point that we wanted the UK to remain in the European Union because of the positive effects on British-Irish relations, the positive effect on North-South relations in Ireland, the positive effect on Northern Ireland.
And Theresa Villiers has been allowed to get away with making statements saying it's the worst sort of scaremongering to say the Good Friday Agreement.
I can only be responsible
and
for
that the border will clearly not have to be recreated.
Theresa Villiers, legal academic, former colleague of mine at King's, is the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, which people might know, and a very leading Brexiteer. It'll be interesting to see if she resumes that position. Very interesting indeed. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. We're going to Tony Travers, our man, who is aware of what's going on. Tony, an update.
Right. Well, as you'll be able to see behind me, the number of votes cast is about 950,000 out of around 32 million. So it's early, 900,000 out of 32 million. So we're talking about 3%, 4% maximum of the votes in so far. And possibly because of where their distribution, at the moment they do show a better position for Leave than the polls, the final opinion polls, and then these two polls that were taken, which we saw at the beginning of the evening. So whilst, the BBC is projecting on Broadcasting House there, simply the running total, so that doesn't tell us much, it just depends on what's come in where of this 3% of the votes so far. As of now, and you can see this from the reaction of the markets, it does look likely to be closer, possibly not, and again, don't quote me on this yet, this is just saying what we've seen so far, it's definitely not going to be an easy win for Remain, and it may not be that at all. So you just need to prepare yourselves. It may be a different result to the one that was originally projected. But we'll have to keep watching these numbers all through
the night. How long do we have to stay up, Tony?
It may be till the last three or four results looking at this.
So it could end up somewhere in Northern Ireland. We're waiting with bated breath.
We could. It could be. But it'd be more likely to be somewhere in Sussex, actually. It'll be somewhere in the rural south. They're the ones that will declare last in the morning.
There'll be a last vote being put in the pile, which will determine whether we remain within the European Union.
Well, you know, it's always been, if you remember back at the beginning of the evening, our imagined 50-50 result. It could get close to that. We just don't know, and it's much, much too early to be certain about this. All I'd say is you can see from some of these responses here that it is, well, as it says here, close. It's close.
Close. Lewis, you're looking at something exciting. Can you share it with us?
Yeah, it's just the pound. I'm seeing my salary vaporize as we speak.
Well, you're never here. You deserve that.
Hey, that's right. That's right. I'm not getting paid either. So, hey. So the third largest in percent pound, in percent terms, the third largest move by the pound ever. Down.
In America.
It's worth saying, I mean, I say this in the company of distinguished economics professors. I mean, of course, if later in the night the results reversed out, I'm assuming it would just go like a V-shape back upwards. But the markets are...
Otherwise, I hope the union reps are around here. We can talk.
Now, look at here. Look at here. There's a lot of indiscipline creeping in. There's a lot of you chatting, reaching over for drink. You're beginning to talk out of turn, if I may say so, Professor. We've only got a few minutes left. Thank you very much, Tony. Let's remember that we have three tremendous experts, two from different jurisdictions, and we have an opportunity to talk to them, and we need to do that for a few minutes. You're the excited Dutch fellow. You may have a question. Do we have any questions? We have a question, and we have another question, and we have a hurtling microphone in your direction. Say who you are, though I know, of course, and then ask your question. And we might take another one if we can find one. Need to be sort of sober. Sober? No, you've asked too many. No, I let
sober
you in.
Question. No,
is it the same question as you tried to ask last time? Okay,
past.
Go.
No. This is unusual. And there's people in the room. That's amazing.
Now, look, stop talking, you people.
Being quick, Carol O'Connor, I wanted to ask you about something around the issue of sense of sovereignty. So that so much of this evening, as it should be, was about economics because this is LSE. However, when we're talking about voters, is it really a reaction to GDP or an earlier panel said income, however you phrase it? But is it possible that some of the Leave people are about sovereignty?
Thank you. Where's this person? There you are. You've got the microphone. Brilliant. Away you go.
It's Ted Apter, studying EU politics here at LSE. My question is about the positive windows of opportunity we have once we have the results, both for UK and EU.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Windows of opportunity to change good things.
Right. Have you got it? Have you got it? And we'll take a third over here. And if we have any other Dutch people, for example, who are former MPs that want to speak, you can easily catch my eye. Just if you want to talk about the prospects.
Have your Dutch...
You have and also Dutch. Confirm you're as happy as that wild, happy fellow with the beer. Yes, sir.
You have to take
okay, Heiko Henkel, European Institute. My question is, isn't Europe really at an impasse at the moment? Because if we look at the British result, whether that is in or out, there's really a tremendous lack of, from a European perspective, of enthusiasm for Europe in Britain and across Europe, as you also said. Now, the only way to change that is clearly to project a European horizon back into the nation states. But exactly that will be extremely difficult now, isn't it? Because the nation states assert their own sovereignty. So how will Europe change in this? How will Europe tackle this conundrum?
Thank you. Thank you. Succinct answers, if we don't mind. Do you mind if Lewis starts? And then Quentin, then Dan.
Sure.
Yes, I wanted to take the window of opportunity one because I did have thoughts on that and I should have. So I do think Europe, as the ambassador was saying, advances by crisis. You know that Jean Monnet had this metaphor about the bicycle, which is always falling, and you just basically advance by keeping moving. You only stay alive if you keep moving. And there are three things Governor Mario Draghi said on June 6th, that the monetary union was weak and incomplete. And there are three things that are needed, that everybody understands that are needed: the federal deposit insurance, joint deposit insurance, a tax of some kind, some fiscal capacity, small but some fiscal capacity, and a potentially some sort of euro bond, which would come together with the Minister of Finance. Those things are needed for monetary union. If the crisis is as big as Quentin expects it to be tomorrow morning, or the markets really get really wild, I would think those windows of opportunity will be there, that suddenly it could happen that Merkel and Holland, although both are very weak politically right now, could meet and could say they're ready to go to the next stage. And that would be massive for Europe, because that would really complete the union.
We've just seen Peter Mandelson's old seat go 70% to leave. There is a story about the collapse of the New Labour project, isn't there? Peter Mandelson's seat. Quentin,
yep.
Comments on the questions,
yeah,
and let then
me,
Dan.
Let me take the first. Let me Thank take you. The sovereignty question, if I may. And I hope this doesn't sound like an answer that's too parti pris. I do believe that some of the significant early and original leaders of the Leave campaign are very substantially concerned by the question of sovereignty. I think that defining sovereignty is very important within that. There is quite a muddle in what we mean precisely. I think parliamentary sovereignty, in a very Westminster definition, is very much part of it. And of course, one of the greatest, most tragic ironies of this referendum campaign is that this referendum is probably the greatest blow to our parliamentary sovereignty that we've ever seen. However, it's supposed to be about reinforcing that parliamentary sovereignty, because that's not part of Europe. So I think that's real. What really saddens me about this campaign is that fundamentally it's been about two project fears. It's been about project fear from the Remain side. It'll all collapse if we go out. And it's been, without any shadow of doubt, about project fear on the Leave side, about fear of foreigners, cut migration. It's all about immigration. Cynically and very dishonestly presented. And although the tragic murder of Joe Cox, I think, stopped it slightly in its tracks, it was already there, and that was the theme that has really brought people out.
And as you speak, Quentin, flashing up behind you are a series of votes for Leave.
Yeah.
Basildon, we expected. Stockton, the Earl of Stockton, was Harold Macmillan, who was the man who, as leader of the Conservative Party, sought to join the European Union and was rejected by Charles de Gaulle. And Merthyr Tydfil, a Labour stronghold, voting to Leave. We are seeing something, whatever the closeness of the result in the end, which is quite dramatic. It's a disowning of a long political tradition, right and left, actually, given that Labour support the so apparently supported. Dan, I think it's the last word before I wrap up and hand over to Kevin Featherstone.
On the question of sovereignty, I have a very clear view on this. As ambassador, I represent a fully sovereign, independent Irish state that is a member of the European Union. And I see, and we see, no contradiction between those two things. In fact, if you look at our experience, the outcomes for the Irish people, if you like, since 1973 have been better than they were before 1973. And for me, that is a kind of an expression of the fact that we've used our sovereignty wisely since 1973 within the European Union, and that that is the ultimate test for me, rather than some kind of notion of sovereignty as an absolute thing that cannot be touched, and if it's ever touched, it is tarnished forever. Second point about the impasse. Well, I think I've heard that phrase a few times during my career, impasse in Brussels, Europe in an impasse. I do think that today's circumstances, I mean, across Europe this last, most of the last decade, have been really quite difficult. But I think to kind of assume that this was some kind of terminal phase in the European Union's history would, I think, be too much of an assumption to make. And I still retain a confidence in the capacity of the European Union to cope.
That's Peter Mandelson's turn.
Not to be triumphant, but to cope.
Let me just wind it up as I hand over to Kevin. We're going to have this show until about 2:45. It'll be TV stuff after Kevin wraps up. Let me tell you something about Ireland. We heard Dan. We had a referendum where we decided that European law was supreme. We had no anxieties about parliamentary sovereignty. Second, more important point, we had a foreign minister, Gareth Fitzgerald, whom we were proud of, and we were proud of Europe throughout from the moment of joining. We had 35 years of sustained support for Europe, which when the collapse came and the pressure rose, was against a backdrop of broad cultural support for Europe. Look at this country. And every single time we had a new road on the way home, there was some evidence on a big board that this was made possible by the EU Regional Fund. We had made clear to our people that we secured deals from Europe. Now, compare and contrast this country. My final point. I had a dinner some years ago with the man who's the keenest advocate of the European project. And he said, if there's a referendum, we lose. And he said, we lose because you cannot undo in 3 months 40 years of collective negativity about Europe and about immigrants. 40 years of party collusion dominating the debate on all sides, turning somebody who believes in immigration into an eccentric, turning somebody who believes in European Union into an eccentric, with each party outbidding the other on the extent to which they can appropriate the prejudices of their people. And it has now come home to roost. And it's a very extraordinary thing to be witnessing. It may or may not be a win for Brexit, but we know it's come home to roost. It's an extraordinary failure of a collective political imagination. Now, that is an editorial at the end. You're allowed stay, but I will be fervently throwing you out at 2:45. Kevin Featherstone, a brilliant event you've organised. Your chance to wrap it up.
It's not over until the fat lady sings. So let me sing you one of my greatest hits here at the LSE. And I say nothing about my failure to respect a diet, but I'm about to sing to bring matters to a close. What a night. A close result has kept you here. A close result and an excellent program of speakers and our panelists have kept us glued to these discussions. As we've heard, there are a number of underlying messages which are lingering there in terms of the ability of our representative democracy to hear the messages coming from public opinion, a sense that our leaders may be out of touch on a number of key issues, issues which previously been regarded as taboo, an issue of immigration which lingers, an issue of parliamentary sovereignty. And indeed, perhaps it's something peculiarly British that if we think about the role of our parliamentary democracy over the last two decades, Parliament, of its own free choice, must have ratified something like 4, 5, perhaps 6 European Union treaties. So we have a referendum somehow to save parliamentary democracy. We have a referendum. The people must somehow save Parliament from its better sense. It is an irony of ironies, if that is the case. Clearly, the questions, the implications are going to linger. We're going to get drunk and think about what might come of our country and Europe. But at least we'll be getting drunk here in the confines of the London School of Economics. So we'll pretend that our getting drunk is actually really an intellectual exercise.
Here, here. Oh.
If you don't wish to hear the fat lady sing, then can I just bring matters to a conclusion? I understand that what we're going to do is to continue to broadcast the TV coverage. This is a much better TV lounge than any of your homes, surely. But in terms of the panel discussions and the events of the evening, this is the end. It is, therefore, the time to say a huge thank you to our chairman, Conor Gearty. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Conor. We loved it so much. In fact, we might have a second referendum night pretty soon. But thank you for coming. Again, thank you for our panelists and the various speakers, the huge number of people who've been involved in making this a success. Personally, I think it is even more successful as an evening, as an event, than we had expected. So thank you for that. You're welcome to continue to look at the TV coverage here. I think we are going to finish matters with the London announcements coming in.
London, entire London? It's one
certain number of ballot papers counted. Central Park, where not very many people live. That's mainly the banking and finance and all the rest of it.
Thank you, Dan.
Expected to go for Remain.
Thank
you. The number of votes cast in favour of Leave was 1087. The number of ballot papers rejected was as follows. 2 for both answers voted for. 4 unmarked or void for uncertainty, giving a total number of 6. Thereby the result for the City of London's area is as declared. Right, so the smallest number of voters of any county in the area apart from the ours is silly, this one. 1,087. What we are waiting for is some of these big London boroughs. Wandsworth, we thought would be a fairly early one in.
We did, but signs up from that borough are looking like more than 70%. Pretty confident in that possible, and a couple of the other boroughs, Whisper is coming a very, very healthy look to them in. So we've seen.
Let's have some more of the results that have come in. Blaine and Gwen. Let's just see that. Main 38, 62 for Leave. The column off in there on the right, you can see.